The scientist reported that there ain't no purpose, and the theologian told me that it's all been designed. And now I'm trying to maintain objectivity. The world wants to illuminate what really matters, and I'm an imperfect mortal meaning extractor, processing the complexity. Born of the earth, we were given a choice. What about free will? Do we have a voice? See them run in place in the human rat race. So much dead weight to our disgrace. Life begins when you accept your fate. Paralysis from forces raging out of control. Until my confidence and will are at an all-time low. Whoa, just directionless wandering. Eternal life, eternal truth, eternal secrets. Isolated hopes and hypotheses just leave you feeling so hungry. Born of the earth, we were given a choice. What about free will? Do we have a voice? See them run in place in a human rat race. Is what you do and not what you say. The roads you take, the friends you make, and those you throw away. The method is a simple synthesis of the past and present state. You never lose if the path you choose is one you can easily navigate. I had a dream, light and carefree, but now there's doubt and gravity.
And Gentile men, boys and girls, coming to you with a view from the rim of the world, the show you've been waiting for. This is Gnostic Media's podcast, episode number 81. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. And that was Shattered Faith, and the music for this episode is by UCLA's Professor Greg Graffin and Bad Religion, in their 31st year on the punk rock scene. And I hope to eventually get Professor Graffin on the show one day, as it would be very cool to have an all Bad Religion episode. And this episode is titled Debunk This, an interview with Acharya S. Part 2. And this episode is being released on Monday, June 21, 2010. My interview with Acharya S., or DM Murdoch, was recorded on June 19, 2010. And after one of the worst colds of my entire life, I'm happy to say that I'm back. And the flu I had started with normal symptoms, but quickly moved into my sinuses and gave me a fever and migraine for about 5 or 6 days, and then made my teeth hurt like hell and spanked me like a little girl. And it was probably multiple things, like moving, dust, not being used to the air at 4,700 feet anymore, not eating properly during the move and all that good stuff, and it just wiped me out. But I'm back and here on the rim of the world. And one of the most controversial religious scholars in the entire world is my guest today, back for round two. And it's been more than a year since she was here last, and she's probably been scheduled for this part two episode for more than a year. And my guest is DM Murdoch, a.k.a. Acharya S., and the only woman that Christians love to hate more than Eve herself. Someone a couple of weeks ago emailed me and asked me how, with all of the wonderful scholars that I've had on my show and teaching the Trivium Method, that I could have a guest, a crank, like Acharya S. on my show. And then they referred me to a Christian apologist website that supposedly debunked her work. And of course, as is typical, the author of the site that this person referenced had never even read her work. But why would I have Acharya on my show twice? No, actually three times. Because, ladies and gents, and I say this with all sincerity, I think that Acharya is one of the best independent scholars out there today. And if you don't believe me, go out and buy her books and read them yourself and see what the real story is behind her research. Don't believe the web blogs and forum write-ups by people who haven't read her works, citing other people who haven't read her works. And the best way to get to the truth is to go out and read it yourself. And what she provides you won't find in watered-down Wikipedia or other encyclopedia websites. And this takes real research and real study if you want to find out the truth. And today's female guest has got the balls to find out what most people are just too afraid to go look for themselves. And her book, Christ in Egypt, is top-notch scholarship, worthy of the best academic publishers and reviews. And you doctors and professors out there listening to this show, and I know there are a lot of you, get this book out and shared with your classes and other college professors, because we need work like this to get out there. And donations. This week, my love and thanks goes out to all of you who sent donations over the last 3 weeks while I was sick, and I really appreciate all of your love and support. To Timothy, Michael, Cynthia, Donald, Justin, Brian, Jeremy, Mr. Finn, Adam, Donald, Arthur, Paul, Randy, Eric, Christopher, Simon, Dr. Craig, Thomas, Sarah, Philip, Luigi, Matthew, Stephen, Oscar, Stephen, Sabrina, and Victoria. And this episode is dedicated to all of you. Thank you so much for your help and for helping to keep things going while I was down. And if you'd like to donate directly to Gnostic Media, please go to the GnosticMedia.com website and click on the donations button up near the top left of the page. This show is run mostly on donations. We are not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or the DVDs or audio archives from the website, you help to continue this programming. And without you, we wouldn't be here. Upcoming shows. Next week, I've got Dr. David Flattery to discuss Paganum Harmala and Ephedra. After that, we'll be talking with James Fadiman, and the week after that, it looks like Alex Gray will be here, and then also Professor John Hupps, Professor Bart Dean, Dr. Thomas Dalton, and Barbara Walker, the author of the new book, Man-Made God, and she will be here with Acharya S. for round three, and also Dr. Dave Nichols and Hank Alberelli to discuss his book, A Terrible Mistake, and Dr. Norman Finkelstein. And also, ladies and gentlemen, it appears that we'll be having the one and only Mountain Girl, Carolyn Garcia, former wife of Grateful Dead lead singer Jerry Garcia, here to talk about the evolution of the American psychedelic movement. And if anyone on the planet had a front row seat for that, you can guarantee that it was this woman. And MAPS. Every week from now on until it's done, we'll be playing at least one talk from the MAPS conference from this last April. And I talked to Rick Doblin this last week, and he agreed to have me play you all of the conference talks right here on Gnostic Media. And we're still offering 25% off of most items on the Gnostic Media website to encourage your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. If you'd like to go to the website is www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Acharya, welcome back to Gnostic Media's podcast.
Well, thank you, guys. Nice to be here.
And it's good to have you back, and you always draw a large audience, whether they've read you or haven't read you, and either typically like you if they've read you and don't like you if they haven't.
Yeah, we do find that many critics have not even read my work. They just have knee-jerk reactions, and then you find them putting up videos and articles and so forth, and they don't know what they're talking about. But and the people who do actually have the educational background and the determination to pursue actually read the books before they make comments, which is a sign of integrity, they tend to like my work, especially people in the field of academia. I've heard from, of course, many over the years who don't really like to come out publicly and say that they embrace my work, but they'll write to me privately, and now and again someone will come forth who's not concerned about whether or not they're going to lose their job over not adhering to the party line, which is basically what a lot of people don't realize is that some of our major universities, some of the older ones, especially in the United States, were started as Christian colleges, universities, and so they have spent a lot of time, obviously, and money to uphold the mainstream Christian perspective. And when you hear these complaints about why doesn't academia know this stuff and why aren't the professors teaching it, well, that's one of the reasons, is that the founders and backers of these universities have often been, in this part of the world, been Christian. So.
Yeah, and actually there are a number of professors that do talk about it, and I've actually had emails from at least, I would say, three or four doctors and professors since I had you on last time that had mentioned to me how much they had liked your work and your books. So they're out there.
Yeah, they're out there, and every once in a while they pop up. Like I said, I have this wonderful Presbyterian minister in Texas who actually has outed himself as a as a fan, and it's a true credit to his vocation, because not only does he understand the work, he's well educated, and he reads my work and can understand it because he's got the educational background, but he's also very inspiring and very uplifting. So this is the kind of thing we need, is people to realize that the information I'm bringing forth is not depressing and unpleasant and something to fear and loathe and so forth. It's actually very fascinating. It's uplifting. It gives.
I would
you
agree
a
with that.
Yes, I think so. I mean, look, the information, when I'm digging this stuff up, I'm like, oh, wow, this is so cool. Some of these stuff, even just a few paragraphs of things that I have managed to dig up, and that's all I'm doing. I'm digging stuff up, and I'm compiling it in books. I'm putting it together in a way that I put things together. I've always been told I'm...
Isn't that kind of what writers do?
Well, if you're doing nonfiction, factual,
yes,
scholarly work.
Yes, exactly.
Although, you can dig up stuff that is not very interesting and not very relevant and so forth. So, it depends on the person a lot. It has to do with their viewpoint, what they're trying to achieve, all that stuff. But
to me,
the information
I was just going to add that, to me, knowing this type of information and writing and researching this stuff myself, it's quite relieving.
Yes.
When you discover what these things are really about, instead of this dogmatic thing that we're told to believe about it, going out and looking and discovering for yourself and finding out all of these ancient texts and things that are out there and are actually available, it's like, oh, well, that really does make so much more sense than this guy who just suddenly appeared and floated up to heaven in this stuff.
And that's the thing, too, is that there's this whole attitude that one must have to adhere to Christianity. Now, I was a Christian, born and raised Christian, Protestant, very mild background, nothing, no hellfire, brimstone. I wasn't tortured by it, wasn't tormented, wasn't abused. It wasn't really in my home. We went to church. It was like a little house on the prairie kind of thing. It was a small, little, nice little congregational church like that. The minister was very nice. Everyone was so nice, and they were all such great people with honesty and integrity and pleasant to be around and so forth and so on. So there was my work in this field has nothing to do with me being angry at God or angry at Jesus or being abused or any of this other psychobabble that people have tried to throw at me over the years. You know, it certainly taught me critical thinking and so forth. But so I'm raised a Christian, and I know what we are as Christians taught to think, which is that, well, this is the way and the truth and the only path to God and so forth, and all the rest are bad and they should be discarded and ignored, and you know, Satan is putting. That's not necessarily what I was taught, but I know that that is the mentality that is very abundant.
So you're saying that all of those ad hominem attacks don't hold water?
Well, being taught that everybody else is evil, who's outside of your narrow purview of reality, and that cultures, pre-Christian cultures, were all full of crazy evil people who were worshiping the wrong gods and sure, there was bad behavior. There always is. There's bad behavior all over the planet. There's bad behavior in Christian communities. There's bad behavior. Yeah, I mean, it just goes on. But and if I'm not saying that the pagan world was a pristine paradise, but this denigration of pre-Christian cultures is totally uncalled for. And a number of people have expressed to me over the, you know, I don't know, a decade and a half on the internet now, but 15 years. They've expressed, you know, absolute relief that they no longer had to feel hatred for every other culture on the planet or every other era or every other religion, that what I was bringing forth from the hoary mists of time were was relieving them of this hatred of other cultures and allowing them to connect to possibly their own pre-Christian ancestry. And their own roots. For example,
To interrupt you again. Isn't it ironic, though, that we've trotted upon our own tribal origins as we've done with the Native Americans here on the so-called Western continents?
Yeah. Well, I find it. I'm a Swedish American and English American for the most part. Scottish, I should say. English, Scottish, Swedish. Those are the prevalent genes. And you know, I mean, I think about the history of what happened in Europe after Christianity began to thrive, and it actually makes my blood boil because these are my ancestors that were denigrated and destroyed. Okay, so I'm not cool with this, not at all. I'm not cool with this. It's like, oh, okay, this you know, this kind of desert slime, this ooze came out of the desert and just ran rampant all over Europe and destroyed all of these wonderful earth-based religions that actually had a basis in reality.
Right.
You know, that came from the own people's observations of what was happening around them in the here and now. Not blind belief in some guy thousands of miles away who may or may not have existed, but our own observations. This is why they are more truthful and more factual. You know, to have somebody come and tell you, look, there's this guy down in Guatemala, his name is Jesus, and he's doing miracles. Now you need to believe that or go to hell. What? What are you talking about? What the heck are you talking about? Get out of here. And in the meantime, this person is becoming more and more aggressive and telling me that, you know, whatever you're perceiving now, your earth-based religions or, you know, your sun worship or whatever, that's all disgusting and vile and trashed, and instead you got to believe in, you know, the Guatemalan guy named Jesus. I find that totally offensive. And so did our ancestors, and they actually fought against this quite vehemently until the leaders were either bought off or threatened. And then the leaders went on rampages against their own people, which are we seeing again right now all over the world vis-a-vis Islam. So that's a whole other story. But, so what I'm doing is really digging up, and I'm trying to bring up as much factual material as possible from the ancient world, primary sources. We're talking tonight specifically, or today specifically, about the my book, Christ in Egypt, which is a big, fat book, jam-packed full of primary source material and the opinions of very highly credentialed authorities, Egyptologists from, you know, the beginning of Egyptology and archaeology to the most modern era. I have 900 sources in this book. I have dug so deeply, it's beyond imagination.
And
I went pages, yes.
I was going to add that we're going to attempt our best at covering topics that we did not cover last time you were on. And we did cover the December 25th birth, the 12, you know, the 12 apostles, the number 12, and things like that. But, you know, I really wanted to focus this particular interview into going deeper into issues that we didn't cover before, so that it's not just a repeat, so that this is actually a part two of the last interview.
Did we talk about the things that I really like, where all this leads to, the culmination of the milieu of the time that around the Mediterranean, where there were just these mystery schools and secret societies and brotherhoods? And
we talked a little bit about that, but I would like to go into a lot more depth on that, like the Alexandrian Essenes and you know, the therapeutes and things like that. You know, and I mentioned last time that reading your book here, and I've read 12 of John Allegro's 13 books, I think, but by his last book, which was called Physician, Heal Thyself, he was pretty much arguing exactly the same conclusions that you came to. And I know that you had referenced one of his books early on, but I don't think that you had studied his other, you know, works that even address this issue. So it was exciting to see another scholar who is just open-minded and looking at the information coming to almost the exact same conclusions.
Yes, I say great minds think alike, huh? Well, you can't really escape the conclusion. If you actually get this book and start digging through it and looking at the stuff that I have brought forth, and some of it was not available in English translations, and I've actually translated some of that. There were a couple of books that were only available in German, and I had to translate those, which were extremely difficult. And then
you mean like the Epiphanius text that we found?
Well, that, yeah, you clued me into that, which was a big help. Yeah, the Epiphanius text is an example of just censorship that is so patently, obviously, religiously based. You know, it was just,
yeah. We probably shouldn't rehash too much of that, because we did cover a lot of that one in the last interview.
All right. Yeah, the Epiphanius. Yeah, that's good, because, you know, I don't want to repeat myself, and this is not freshest in my mind of late, I have to say. I'd have to read this whole book again to have... You can't memorize. This is what people think, that, you know, I know every fact that's in my books. I really don't remember every fact that's in my books.
I just, so you don't feel bad, I have to read my own books probably once every month or two just to remember what I wrote in my own stuff.
Well... It isn't like we're sitting here making it up out of our own brains. That's the thing. We're digging this stuff up out of other texts and putting it in, I'm the puzzle putter together. I'm just taking this stuff and I'm putting it together in a form that I hope will impart a worldview. And this worldview is very interesting, I believe. It really fills up this idea that there was this whole, you know, world of barbarism and lack of civilization, and it needed this Judeo, Samaritan guy named Jesus Christ to come along to enlighten us all out of our darkness. This is such a false notion.
But if you take barbarism on what the word is really supposed to mean, which is hairy people or bearded people, like where we get the word barber from, then it makes sense, you know, because then you're just talking about a barber who needs to cut somebody's beard. And Sure, there were probably lots of barbers and lots of hairy people.
But in fact, it sounds like you're describing the Semitic peoples, whereas the Romans were clean-shaven. So,
yeah, that's true. And very short. You're right.
So anyway, here's what this extensive research does, and it to restore the ancient world to its grandeur. I mean, the people who built the pyramids, the people who built the Parthenon, which I've stood on several times, and the public is not allowed to go up there anymore. These people were not savages who were totally unenlightened. The Greeks are known for their philosophy. Aristotle, Socrates, Plato. I mean, these are great thinkers. Do they have problems with their society? Yes. No one is saying that there was any utopia going on all over the planet. Same thing with the Egyptians. Egyptians had certain issues, obviously. I mean, for one thing, let's just talk about their diet. They had a lot of sand in their diet, which wrecked their teeth. So they were not living in paradise. But they had, the ability to build these incredible ruins. And it's not just buildings, I should say. They weren't ruins at the time, obviously. But it's not just the pyramids. I mean, there are just massive temple complexes all over Egypt. And that culture thrived for at least 3,000 years. And it reached such peaks, even in their philosophizing. It's a different flavor than the Greek, obviously. But the culture, the Egyptian religion, is absolutely fascinating. Now, if you look at it like I did when I was a kid, and I thought, what is all this goofy stuff with the crocodile heads and the ibis heads and so forth? This is not something I want to look at. Just seemed all kind of weird and wacky and alien from Mars. But when I started reading it in the context of the whole Mediterranean and the Christian era, Common Era, Christian era, and that the entire, the entire context, so when you start reading, you start studying it in that way, then in the astrotheological context, I should add, then it actually starts to have some serious, profound meaning. And that was one of the things that propelled me along, was like, wow, this is really fascinating. This culture has been eradicated, denigrated, pushed aside, ridiculed, and yet for 3,000 years they managed to thrive in, I say, relative harmony as a group mind, in a sense, to build a fantastic civilization.
And ironically, their philosophies have overran our own, but most people are completely unaware of it.
As it turns out, there is little about Christianity, for example, that cannot be found in the ancient Egyptian religion. There is practically nothing about Christianity that can't be found there. This is a 3,000-year creation. It was an ongoing thing. It didn't
stop.
So
you're saying it didn't just happen overnight on December 25th?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
But
all right.
I should
probably cut my sarcasm down a little bit. But, what we should probably do before we jump into Egypt is let's talk about what exactly is astrotheology.
All righty then.
We'll give people sort of a foundation, and then we'll build up from there.
Well, the word now, that since the middle of the 19th century, has come to mean the ancient religion whereby people revered, honored, worshipped natural elements and entities, particularly the sun, moon, stars, constellations, planets, and Earth. You can actually factor into this astrotheological umbrella earthly characteristics such as wind, water, and so forth, because they're not separable. I mean, you can't separate in ancient Egyptian, for example, you can't separate the god Osiris, who has many solar attributes, from the Nile River and the water. So the water and the sun are related. They have some relationship and so forth. And so when I say astrotheology, I'm also incorporating nature worship in general. But the focus, the astro part, astro, star in Greek, has to do with, of course, the sun, the moon, the stars, the celestial bodies, Venus, Sirius, constellations such as Orion, and so on. And so that would be astrotheology. And when you start looking at the ancient ruins, and we're finding so many of them, this is an exciting time to be alive for that reason alone. I mean, the ruins that are coming to light, and they're being looked at with a more scientific and pristine eye, rather than one from the bias of trying to prove the Bible, for example. This information that's coming forth, and we're finding, I mean, you know, to look at these massive ruins and think that they didn't have any kind of sophisticated thinking to go with them has been has been a serious problem with this science of archaeology. And so, you know, he's like, well, there's a bunch of savages and barbarians who threw up these massive buildings. I mean, it's just a real disconnect. So what my work is doing is putting the sophisticated thinking back to, you know, attaching it to these ruins. Obviously, the people who created these fantastic buildings must have had some intelligence and wisdom and knowledge and education. They weren't just grunting savages who were beating each other on the heads with sticks. I mean, this is the impression that we're getting. These were horrible.
Well, you know, and that's it's interesting that you bring that up about you know, the architecture in Egypt and things like that. And people are so prejudiced against ancient cultures that I hear it so commonly said, and I hear it all the time. People would rather look at UFOs creating the monuments of Peru, for instance, than the Incas and the Peruvian people having built them themselves.
That's right.
And it's this ridiculous nonsense that, oh, well, they're brown people, they were too primitive, they couldn't have done these things. How about, no, we're the ones who are ignorant, we're the ones who don't get how it was done. That doesn't mean that these other people didn't. That is our own lack of knowledge and our own inability to understand. And so therefore, you know, we projected into some heavenly something or other. And where did the UFOs come from? Never mind that. But, you know, well, UFOs came and did it because the Peruvians and the Egyptians, they were just too dumb.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, or even, I mean, Stonehenge, doesn't matter what the skin color is, but all these incredible buildings that I'm doing is showing what was the motivating mental, spiritual, emotional factor that caused them to create these fascinating things that they left behind. And of course, these are just what we can see of their culture. These stones, that's all that's left. You know, there was all kinds of other artifacts that indicated high civilization. I mean, Egypt is so full of this material, that's why I keep going back to it, but that there are even people, scholars who specialize in Egyptian wigs, you know, wig making, and that's actually a very important part of putting the rest of the history of Egypt together. Believe it or not, it's like potsherds for dating techniques. So, you know, we're talking, these weren't like just savages who were dressed in furs and running around grunting and so forth. There was some high sophistication. What were their beliefs? What were they thinking? Well, the most obvious and easily identifiable belief systems dating back thousands of years had to do with the natural world, our natural order. Fertility was really well revered. There's, you know, you can understand why. So then we have these fertility goddess cults. And these are, you know, it becomes very obvious. There's nothing like really weird and alien about this. There's nothing that needs to be refuted or disputed. It's just real common sense obvious. If you were to go and sit on a mountain and you were, like, let's say 6,000 years ago in Turkey, which we're finding massive amounts of culture coming out of Turkey now. It's fantastic what's being discovered there. I can't even pronounce the place. There, you know, there's Katol Hoyuk, and then there's Şatal Hoyuk, and then there's this new Göbekli Tepe, these crazy names, but the amazing sites that are coming out of there, very sophisticated, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 years old. So if you were to project yourself back in that kind of primordial world, you would probably find yourself in awe of your surroundings, especially if, you know, you combined this setting with your favorite topic, some kind of entheogen or something, you would certainly have a sensation of tremendous awe and reverence for your natural world. The moon and its phases would be so striking. And then that feeling, which I really think is quite healthy, I mean, it gives you a reason for wanting to be alive on the planet. It's that feeling of, wow, what an experience of being alive. I mean, this is incredible. Our natural world is just awesome. But even you know, beyond that feeling, just a natural observation for practical purposes. The moon phases had practical reasons for being observed. They needed to be observed. The sun's movements through the year, when to plant, when to harvest. The rising of the Nile was incredibly important for the Egyptians. Life would not continue if the Nile did not overflow its banks and flood the river, the banks and cause the green grass to grow and all the rest of the agriculture that they needed to thrive and live. So it was not only to them, this natural world was not only astonishing, but their observations of it were obviously very practical and important too. And so astrotheology describes this process of taking all this information about what the sun does every day. It obviously rises and sets from our perspective. What the sun does every month, what the sun does every year, what the moon does every month, and so forth, the waxing and the waning. That information was, you know, in a time or a place where there's no writing, you want to have some way of conveying this to the next generation. And so they used symbols, and of course then later on in the writing, obviously, but there were oral stories told, and they personified these entities. They personified the sun, they personified the moon, Venus, Mars, all the planets and the stars that they could observe, you know, especially with the naked eye, obviously, until there was telescopes. But and to pass them along, especially if you're trying to teach children, well, you tell stories. Well, the sun is named so-and-so, and the sun did this and that. And it becomes a myth. It becomes a story about a person or people, you know, many people interacting, the sun and the moon. The sun and the moon, often the sun is male, the moon is female. The female is receiving the light of the sun and becoming impregnated by it. And this is another way of conveying information about how the sun's light is reflected in the moon's surface. So all this stuff, when you start coming across it, suddenly the world makes a lot more sense. Suddenly our stories make more sense. Suddenly the myths are not just meaningless, silly stories. And in addition to that, you now have the motivation for these massive ruins that we can clearly see. And you have the reasons for various astronomical alignments, archaeoastronomy. Why did they need to have the stones aligned at Stonehenge to the solstices, the equinoxes, the moon phases, and so forth? So this is like a giant celestial computer. And it's not just a computer, though. It's not just an astronomical observatory. It's also a temple. So you put these two things together, astrotheology, you see. So that's what astrotheology is. It really is a kind of a generalized description of a nature worship that is found all over the planet based on, you know, your ability to observe from wherever you are. So it's a common theme, and it's a common theme that unites humanity beyond all of the divisiveness that we find in politics and religion today. And it also shows the origins and roots of our so-called modern religions as well. And this is where we start getting into trouble. The, you know, the people, the purveyors of the revealed, the so-called revealed religions, which are mostly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they're claiming that a whole cloth, out of the blue, out of a vacuum, out of nothingness, appeared this revelation. Well, that is absolute baloney. And that baloney is not just a funny little quirk that we could, oh, well, you know what, let's just indulge people in believing in this baloney. It's been very damaging, very detrimental, very horrendously destructive to the planet, traumatic to the human soul, this idea you know, this the divine revelation just struck us out like a thunderbolt out of the blue, where we had nothing else before that.
Right.
Hugely destructive.
Let's get into the nuts and bolts of this. Why don't we start off with the connection between Osiris and Horus?
Well, here's the confusion that people get when we're talking about. Assume that a number of people have watched the movie Zeitgeist, because that's a good familiar starting point, and they'll see that these characteristics are claimed of Horus, that he has similar parallels to the life of Christ. And it isn't just Horus that we're talking about, because Horus and Osiris in the Egyptian mythology are often interchangeable. In fact, one becomes the other throughout the day, every day, and even during the year. The one becomes the other. Horus is the morning sun. Osiris is the night sun. And there's all kinds of finessing of Egyptian thought in here. You know, whether they were monotheistic, polytheistic, they seem to be simultaneously both. There's a concept that the solar orb is not being discussed. It's the power behind the sun. So all of these things, these nuances, I'm addressing all of them. I address them all in my book, Christ in Egypt. So if you think you have an objection, like, well, it's not really the sun. Well, yeah, I know that. I understand that. But for terms, in order to be able to communicate, we can talk in these terms. The sun passes through different phases during the day and the night. And this is in the Egyptian thinking. As it goes through, it kind of merges with other gods who are not necessarily sun gods. They could be the sky god. They could be the god of the afterworld, like Osiris is. But for all intents and purposes, they do become those gods. The sun does become those gods. So the sun is born in the morning as Horus, achieves adulthood at noon as Ra. Then from noon to 6 is, let's just say 6 a.m. is when Horus is born. From noon to 6 is Atum. And from 6 to midnight, how does that work? Oh, wait a second. Atum, no, I'm sorry. From noon to 6 is Ra. From 6 to midnight is Atum. From midnight to 6 a.m. is Osiris. And so it was, they're really,
are you, are you telling us that our word for fall, autumn, is directly related to ancient Egyptian religion?
Well, no, it would actually be more related to Adam, like A-T-O-M. But no, Atum, Atmu, the pronunciation is sort of up for grabs with ancient Egyptian. They're basing it on Coptic pronunciation. But
With autumn, though, wouldn't it be, if it's the 6 hours that it's falling in that time of year, would that be related to the time of day?
Well, without going into a strict etymology, it's not a bad correlation to see. I mean, it's kind of like that whole argument about sunset, and does set have something to do, the god Set have something to do with sunset. Yeah, etymology is not a precise science. It's difficult to say where words come from. But so, it's possible. It's like the word, the Egyptian twat. Now, I mean, there's all kinds of things, places we could go with that word, too. The twat is like the underworld. You know, it's this dark and scary place. I mean, there's all kinds of monsters in there. Did that word, find its way in our vocabulary?
I'll leave that one alone.
We can call it the duat for now, so we don't get all confused, huh?
Yeah, there you go.
So Osiris and Horus become interchangeable in different parts. And now, with this night and day, this rebirth, death and rebirth issue, comes the Egyptian afterlife, which itself is amazingly important. The Egyptian religion is like, the whole thing is based on perpetuation. They want so desperately to have an afterlife. You know, I'm sure life was rough and tough and cheap back then, so in a large part, but of course not with the pharaohs. No expense was spared there. But, and so the pharaoh is the living Horus. The pharaoh is the god on earth, And when the living Horus dies, he becomes the Osiris. And so the Osiris then is resurrected into the afterlife. And you know, this is especially important for the royalty, obviously. But even the common Egyptians were so interested in, I mean, even the common Egyptians would bury themselves on the edges of the desert so that they could become mummified. They couldn't afford mummification often, you know, most of the time. And it's been estimated that there were 500 million mummies. Can you believe
that?
I mean, we know that they found over in Europe when they started digging around in Egypt after Napoleon, that they started finding all these mummies, and they were actually grinding them up and putting them in teas and whatnot. Can you believe that? I mean, isn't that cannibalism? What is crazy stuff is that? You know? But so there are estimates are that there were 500 million followers of the Egyptian religion altogether over the 3,000-year period. And that most of these were buried in an Egyptian manner. They'd be either mummified or preserved, like, say, being buried in the desert. And
wow.
So going along with this is this massive amount of literature that has to do with passing into the afterlife, how to procure it, where you're going to go, what the procedures would be for royalty as opposed to common people, rich common people, poor people. There's a huge amount of literature. And I sifted through it. I sifted through quite a lot of the coffin text, the pyramid text. Phew. You know, it's been a while, but that was quite a grueling exercise, I'll tell you. I had to learn Egyptian on the spot, and I mean, it's just not easy either. And of course, I don't know that much. The Egyptian hieroglyphs, there's like 2,000 of them.
As opposed to our alphabet? Yeah, that sounds a little bit complicated.
Well, yeah, it's more like Chinese. Can you imagine? Just that alone should indicate that we're talking about a high culture here. You know, this is not a bunch of bone through the nose savages. If they have 2,000 hieroglyphs, then they must have other concepts that are profound, you know, that they're trying to depict. They're not just crazy. They had all this incredibly profound information about just esoteric things that we hardly even think about. Now, these would be the mysteries as well. Of course, there are loads of Egyptian mysteries as they were passed down into. This is what we're looking at. You know, Jan, you know very well that what we're looking at in Christianity is the exoteric manifestation of the ancient mysteries that had been developed
Indeed.
In Egypt, India, Babylon, Sumeria, even Greece and Rome, and later.
In fact, didn't Timothy and Freak write a whole book just on that single topic alone?
Yeah, maybe on the exoteric manifestation of the mysteries.
Right,
well,
I think
Jesus
that was
mysteries.
Their
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, that's what they're calling that. But that book was almost exactly the same as my book, Christ Conspiracy, which is really interesting because we used different sources, we wrote it at the same time, and we had no influence on each other. So when I read that book, my mouth dropped open, and I said, "My God, this is almost the same as my book." And so, you know, you have a group of people now coming to the same conclusions and seeing the same points with different sources. So anyway,
right.
You know, the interchangeability of Osiris and Horus is an important fact to note because some of the characteristics that we attribute to Horus are actually part of Osiris's story and vice versa. So, but I do distinguish them very thoroughly in my book and show exactly who is what and what they did and what they said and supposedly so forth and so on.
All right. Well, let's talk about John the Baptist. Did he have an Egyptian counterpart?
That's one of the more fascinating parts of the story. The whole idea of baptism, the fact that it was even discussed in the Bible as if it already existed. I mean, he's a Baptist. He's already doing it. Shows that it didn't just start with Jesus. So we know from even the Catholic Encyclopedia admitting against interest that baptism is a very old tradition and ritual that goes back thousands of years and is found all over the world. And of course, it differs. I mean, in India, you have a lot of immersion into the River Ganges and other rivers. Then there's in Rome, we find a tradition of sprinkling water, like they would go around the Colosseum or something, or a public gathering, and sprinkle water on people, and that was their kind of voodoo to keep away the bad things. And this was totally uninfluenced by Christianity, obviously. And so, naturally, we would expect to find some form of baptism in ancient Egypt as well. And we would expect to find someone doing the baptizing. And I had, in my book, The Christ Conspiracy, I had briefly raised this character called Anup the Baptizer as a parallel to John the Baptist. And so, you know, of course, a lot of people jumped up and down and started screaming. They sure did. There's a chapter in my book, The Christ Conspiracy, called The Characters. And that chapter has gotten so much attention that it really clues you in that this is the Achilles heel, you know, here. They're not freaking out about the chapter on the Bible, sex, and drugs. They're not freaking out about the chapter on the Zadokites and the Essenes and the Therapeutes. They're not freaking out about any of the rest of the book. They're just that characters chapter really freaks them out. And so they go through this, and I'm talking about the Christians largely and the believers, that they go through this chapter and they look at each little, it's done in a bulleted list format. And so they go through each one and they try to rip apart every sentence that I've written there. And that's not true. And this is not. And I have lists of so-and-so was born of a virgin, so-and-so was born on December 25th, and all the way down the line. And in the Egyptian one, I had Anup the Baptizer. Now, I knew that this was referring to Anubis. And I knew that Anubis was not traditionally depicted in encyclopedias as having anything to do with baptism, per se. I mean, they don't call it baptism. He is the mortuary, the person who embalmed, the embalmer of the Osiris. The Osiris is the dead pharaoh, in the most important role. Any dead person who's being talked about in using the Book of the Dead or the coffin text is the Osiris. But, when these things were specifically, the pyramid texts were specifically written for the rich pharaohs, then the Osiris would only be a pharaoh, obviously. But, so anyway, so we have Anubis being the embalmer of the Osiris. And, so Anubis is embalming Osiris. But then, digging more deeply, if you go and you look in an encyclopedia, that's all you see, and then you go, that's not true, he didn't baptize or whatever, but then you dig a little deeper. The encyclopedia does not contain everything. Did you know that? It's a small entry. I have a 600-page book here, not a small 2-paragraph entry, okay? There is no encyclopedia that has all the information that you seek. So I found just the most wonderful material on this character Anubis and how he, in fact, does baptize the Osiris. So he's you know, just as John the Baptist is baptizing Jesus for a particular purification purpose, so too is Anubis purifying the Osiris. And the word baptism actually, actually means to purify. So you call him Anubis the purifier, if that, you know, rings your bell. But it's, for all intents and purposes, it's the same as Anup the Baptizer or John the Baptist. Now, the interesting thing about, there's actually images of, you know, Anubis, like, pouring, or Horus pouring the eternal life symbol, the Ankh, or water symbols, over Osiris. So you could see, even Egyptologists have used the word baptism when it comes to what the royal, the pharaoh or the Horus or the Osiris goes through. So we definitely have a purification ritual, and this figure of Anubis, oddly enough, Anubis is missing his head. Does that sound familiar?
Well, John the Baptist doesn't lose his head on a platter.
Well, Anubis is decapitated, and his head is replaced by a jackal. So there's obviously there's a difference, but you have a decapitated person who is a baptizer. I wonder where that story came from. You know, and the other thing is when you rip all of this out of the context and you put it like, you see these movies where the whole world is dark and dingy and there's this light being shined in Judea and all you see is this little nothing kind of town with no real construction and so forth. Then you see the whole world is like that.
I thought you were talking about a Scientology film for a second.
But you are only seeing these movies and you don't know anything about the rest of the world at that time, you're totally ripping it out of context, you have no milieu, then you're not seeing the whole picture. And the whole picture is that when Christ was supposedly born and, you know, running around Judea, these gods of Egypt, and there were many gods going on in Mediterranean at the time. The Roman Empire had opened up all kinds of avenues, and Alexander the Great before that, and we had Indian gods there too. We had the Library of Alexandria with 500,000 books in it, and you can be sure that there were the stories of practically every god in the known world at the time. And they were allowed in the Roman world. The Romans were very tolerant of all manner of gods from, you know, Africa too. I mean, all over the place. And so some of the most prominent ones were the Egyptians, of course, because everybody was wowed by the Egyptian culture. It had been huge, and it was hugely important long before the Greeks and the Romans. So the Egyptian gods had made tremendous inroads all the way up to Great Britain. You find temples of Isis. Now, Isis brings with her, she was the great healer. She was called the great healer. She was also called the great virgin. Before the Common Era, Temple of Seti at Abydos is one place. That's the 13th century BCE, called the Great Virgin. So if you've gone to the encyclopedia and you found out that she was impregnated by Osiris's phallus, it doesn't matter. It's a myth. She's still the Great Virgin. Okay? So anyway, Osiris's worship was hugely important, the great healer, in the Mediterranean right at that time that Christ was supposedly being born. And along with her, she brought her major entourage. I mean, one of the most important figures in the entourage besides Horus and Osiris was this figure of Anubis. And Anubis was, you know, vitally important because everybody dies, and Anubis is like, you know, a major transitioner into death. And so it wasn't like this was some obscure figure that nobody could have possibly heard about, this Anubis the baptizer, who was decapitated. He was a very important figure. And even that figure is a kind of a universal. There's another water figure called Ioannis, which is basically the same name as, or is it say Ioannis, basically the same name as John in Greek, which is Ioannis. Ioannis, the Babylonian water god. And so, you know, you factor in these different characters and you start to think, well, obviously John the Baptist is not a historical figure either. This is a mythical figure that has been adopted and Judaized. So that's John the Baptist, Anuk the Baptizer. The book Christ in Egypt has how many pages is it? It's got 20-something pages. 25 pages on Anup the Baptizer, and I think it's really fascinating. And then I have some images, too, from Book of the Dead and so forth. And it's fascinating stuff, really.
All right, let's talk about the cross. Are you going to tell me that the Egyptians had their version of the cross, too?
Well, a lot of people know about the Ankh, but they don't really look at the Ankh necessarily very closely. You know, the Ankh is what is called the Crux Ansata. It has a like a oval on the top, which, in fact, if you look at it, looks like a human being in cruciform, a human being with his arms outstretched. So, you know, I mean, just think about that a minute. A human being with his arms outstretched was the most important, really, arguably the most important religious symbol in all of Egypt. You know, I mean, if you drew a stick line drawing around Jesus Christ on the cross, it might look quite a lot like an Ankh. You know what I'm saying? And in fact, the Ankh itself, which is called a cross, the Crux Ansata, was a symbol for eternal life. Wow. Now, they had a symbol, a cross symbol for eternal life in Egypt for, I don't know, a couple thousand years before Jesus Christ supposedly existed. So, that's one important correspondence that really needs to be kept in mind. Now, this cross, is sometimes depicted in an anthropomorphic stance. In other words, it's like a human being. It has hands on the end of its of the crossbar. So again, that imagery of a human on a cross is not lost on the Egyptians. And we find, I mean, that opens up a whole can of worms. It's not just in Egypt. But specifically in Egypt also, there was this talk of Osiris being on a cross or in a cross shape or having some kind of, not Osiris, well, Osiris is depicted in a similar form, but Horus is also depicted as with arms outstretched. And this theme of cruciform, you don't necessarily have to be on a piece of wood, but an image of someone who's revered, could be a god or a goddess, is in a shape of a cross. This was an important icon in the pre-Christian world. The cross itself is important. It goes back even farther than Egyptian. There are different forms of crosses. Some of the, you know, the crossbar is raised up a bit, and that's like the Christian cross, and then there's some that is equal lengths. And but these are what they all stand for largely is the sun, S-U-N, the sun. This is sun worship. You'll find these images, these crosses all over the place representing the sun. And from an astrotheological perspective, what that would represent is, in large part, would be the equinoxes and the solstices. And so this is a way to designate an entire solar year is in the shape of a cross. I found solar symbolism, this is kind of a funny story. I was doing archaeology on Crete, and I'd been on Crete, the island of Crete in Greece, several times. I actually love that place. It's just so mysterious and cool. So I was at some of these major sites, like I think it was at Festos. They're like 4,000 years old and very sophisticated. And everybody's looking at all this monumental building, look at all these massive stones over here, or they're talking about bull jumping or something. And all of a sudden, my attention was drawn to these mason's marks in the rocks. And I was like, what? But these are so cool. There's like these little mysterious symbols all over the rocks. And so I don't know if somebody's done a study of mason's marks, a really, you know, sophisticated scientific study, but that would be really interesting. And these, so we're talking, you know, 4,000 or 4,500-year-old marks on these rocks that nobody ever talks about. And I looked at these and I was like, wow, what are they trying to convey here? And we find out that's interesting is that these mason's marks are found all over the world in rocks, and some of them are the same. And a lot of times they are clearly solar symbols. They'll draw something like, it looks like a V with a circle in the middle, and like a mountains with the sun in the middle, and other marks like this. And some of them look like little men with rays around their heads. And they're, you know, then we find these petroglyphs all over the place. So we have this enormous solar cross symbolism going back thousands of years, and that is the cross. And of course, the cross is eternal life. It had to do a lot to do with the sun renewing itself every day and every year. And we know what that comes about every year with the spring, vernal equinox, the resurrection of life out of the death of winter, and then of course culminating with the death and rebirth at Christmas time, the winter solstice.
Lazarus.
Ah, Lazarus. Yeah, there's another fascinating thing there. The story of Lazarus in the New Testament tells the tale of Jesus calling forth a smelly, rotten guy, his like best friend, or the two women, his family, he's known the family. They come to him and they're begging for him to do something about their brother Lazarus, who has died. And he goes very dramatically to the entrance of the tomb where Lazarus is and calls him forth. And then, you see in these movies, it's like zombie mummy stumbles out into the bright light. Ah! And he's resurrected and everybody's happy and so forth. Well, as it turns out, may not be any surprise here, but that story is paralleled in detail in Egypt before Christianity. And now, when I say it's a story, you have to remember that until the Greeks were introduced to the Egyptian culture, the Egyptians didn't necessarily write their myths in story form, like an encyclopedia entry. And even today, what you're reading in an encyclopedia about certain myths is not necessarily how the ancients told them. They didn't sit around and say, well, at the beginning, the god Loki was born, and then he moved on to do this and that and do this and that, especially in Egypt. It was more like you have these texts that have characteristics of the gods in them, or possibly a couple of anecdotes about them in the text, like the pyramid text, but they're not compiled in a narrative form. And so until the Greeks then, like the Diodorus Siculus, or a little later Plutarch, start recounting the characteristics and sayings of the gods in story form. Okay, so I'm not saying that someone was back there telling the story of, El Osiris was called forth at the tomb with the two sisters, but when you break down the elements of it, you find, okay, here we have Jesus calling forth Lazarus. Here we have Horus calling forth El Osiris, Lazarus, Osiris. Actually, Osiris's name is Osar or Asar. And in fact, in my book, I show the etymology of the word Lazarus is quite clearly related to Osar, Osiris. And the other elements of this story, for example, they said Lazarus is called forth on the fourth day. Well, Horus calls forth Osiris on the fourth day. Horus is depicted as raising Osiris. The priest takes the role of Horus. The dead person takes the role of Osiris. The priest raises Osiris from the dead. Horus raises Osiris from the dead. And this happens constantly throughout that's like a major theme in the Egyptian religion. Horus raising Osiris from the dead. And then it goes back to the sun in the morning being resurrected from the death of the night. Osiris becomes Horus, and so on and so forth. But this raising forth, I actually found, I've got in my book, I've got these parallels between the Gospel of John and the different Egyptian texts. And I show that it's almost like they copied it verbatim. They've got the two women are the sisters. Well, at Osiris's death, he is mourned by his two sisters. And these two sisters are called the Mertes, or the Merte. And the two sisters who mourn Jesus, or the two women who mourn Jesus. Well, first, the ones who, there's two deaths there that are being conflated, obviously. We have Lazarus has Mary and Martha. And so those are like Mary, Merte. I mean, it's basically the same name, Mary, Martha, Merte. So we've got the two sisters who are basically named Mary or Marte. Then we've got also at the death of Jesus, the resurrection of the death of Jesus, we have the two Marys. So there's all these women who are named Mary at the death or resurrection of the God. And there are all these other different elements to this story. And you cannot escape the conclusion that this is an Egyptian myth, that they have taken this very important, like I said, it wasn't necessarily rolled into a story, but it would be a ritual. And the ritual itself, if you have a 500 million people going through this ritual over a period of 3,000 years, it's not something very obscure. You know, it's very popular and well-known. And if you're going to try to supplant that religion, you're going to have to give them an alternative. So now instead of this religion, this ritual of Horus raising Osiris, and the women mourning his death and rejoicing his resurrection, you have to incorporate that into your new religion. That's like a key part of ancient Egyptian religion. And so then they turn this into the story of Lazarus being resurrected from the dead. It's so obvious. I mean, it becomes, you read the book, it becomes so patently obvious when you get all these pieces put together. And what also becomes obvious in the story of the Gospel of John is that it is very Egyptian. Its provenance is Egypt. It's got Egyptian stories in it. The people who are making the first commentaries on it are in Egypt. It's Egyptian. It was written for an Egyptian audience. It was written for an Egyptian Gnostic audience in particular. And all of a sudden, if you read the information and you realize how Egyptian this book is, it all starts to make sense. Where it came from, when it was created, 2nd century, not 1st, 2nd century, why it says some of the strange things that are in there, why it's different from the other three, all of these things start to make sense. All those mysteries, all those secrets and hidden meanings, they all come out. It's all making sense now, instead of this, you know, odd ball story that just happened out of nothing.
Let's jump back to Horus for a second. Do the pyramid texts discuss Horus being set to rise? In other words, do the pyramid texts show him being prepared to rise?
Horus?
Horus, well, yes.
Well, no, not exactly. I mean, the texts, the funerary texts are to, I mean, Osiris and Horus, the deceased is called both Osiris and Horus. These, like I said before, we were talking about the interchangeability. The priesthood themselves had, I mean, I don't say they have trouble separating them. I think it was quite deliberate. They didn't separate necessarily Horus from Osiris, but it's really Osiris that is being raised from the dead. But Horus is also talked about, the name of the deceased is also called the Horus. So yes, if the Horus is being raised from the dead, you know, I mean, then you can say that it's in the pyramid text or it's in the funerary literature. But the story of Horus being raised from the dead is actually written out nicely for us in a first century BCE text, before the Common Era text, written by Diodorus of Siculus. Where he tells a story of how Horus is betrayed by Set as a scorpion and killed, and Isis raises him from the dead. So here we have a death and a resurrection of a god in the first century before the Common Era, undoubtedly. There's no arguing it. And the amazing thing about this story, about Horus being raised from the dead, is that Diodorus, writing in the first century, before the Common Era, uses the exact same word in Greek that is used in the New Testament to describe Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Anastasis. The Anastasis of Horus has now become the Anastasis of Jesus. And so you have these, you know, these small correlations that all start to add up. And I don't even consider that one a small one. I think that's a pretty big one. That's a big deal to me. That is like, wow. You know, could you just, why didn't you just copy Diodorus' text when you were describing Jesus' resurrection? You know, there's things like that. So there's where the story of Horus being raised from the dead comes in. Although, again, when in the ancient texts, he is also described, the deceased is described as the Horus, then you have, yes, you have another resurrection there.
In your opinion, why were Jews blamed for Christ's death?
Well, you have a lot of factors at play in the New Testament composition. At the time that it was being created, there were so many different factions that were vying for dominance. Now, most of the factions were, you know, interested. I mean, they were just happy that they were being allowed to exist and being tolerated. And I'm talking about religious sects and cults and brotherhoods and secret societies and so forth. You find this kind of odd love-hate relationship with the emperors and the politicians with various secret societies. You know, one minute they're members of them, the next minute they're banning them, and it goes on like this throughout several centuries. So there is this huge amount of different sects and cults from all over the place. But there were some that were pushing for dominance, and one of them we could state would be the Judean one, the Jewish cult, of course. I mean, it says right in the text, the Old Testament, that they're the chosen people and that their religion is the religion and is the only one allowed. And, you know, the monotheistic the whole nine yards, the whole Old Testament is conquering and slaughtering all the people who don't believe in Yahweh. And so, you know, this carried over, obviously. And they were considered the most stubborn members of the Roman world. They were a real problem. I think it was Seneca who's describing them. He's like, you call him one of the early anti-Semites, I suppose. But he's saying that these stubborn people are destroying the Roman Empire and so forth. And so there was a problem there. They had a constant, like, for example, I mean, okay, the Romans are occupying Judea. And so, I mean, as you might expect, the Judeans are not going to just sit back, and they're constantly, like, harassing the Romans. They want them out. This is like this whole Middle Eastern thing that we see now is still that these dirty, filthy infidels are ruining our country. And, you know, that reminds me of Monty Python's Life of Brian. What have the Romans ever done for us? Well, besides the aqueducts, the schools, the roads, the hospitals. If you've seen that part, but it's hilarious. So they were, of course, very interested in getting rid of the Romans. They were always attacking the Romans. There was always a Messiah being born every minute, and he was going to overthrow the Roman rule. And there are texts being written against the Romans. You know, I mean, really. I mean, also in Life of Brian, I say you're the Messiah, and I should know. I've followed a few. You know, there's only supposed to be one. Okay, you can't follow a few. I love those guys. So, I mean, they really got it down. They really did. So so we're talking about the Jews are really rabble-rousers. But at the same time, and I know this is going to be shocking to you, but arguably.
To me, well, are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure this is really going to shock you. That did you know that the wealthiest family in the Roman Empire at the time, during the first century, was Jewish? I know that's going to shock you. But, yes, there was a Jewish family in the Roman Empire, supposedly the wealthiest, possibly on Earth at the time. It's hard to say what was going on in China.
I don't believe it. Are you talking like Goldman Sachs rich, or how rich are you talking?
We're going to be tarred and feathered.
I didn't say, I just...
I know, it is
call
very
it like
ironic.
You see but... it, you know, it's like right there in your face.
Well, in any event, you can kind of understand that if, you know, the richest family in the Roman Empire is Jewish, there might be a little bit of Jewish influence on religion at the time. And so, of course, now this would be, interestingly enough, this would be the family of Philo of Alexandria, Philo the Judean of Alexandria. And Philo, what is so interesting about this is that Philo left
He wasn't
for
a lover,
us.
Was he?
Philo. He wasn't a lover. Yes, the word philos in Greek. Philosophia, love of wisdom. He left for us one of the most, one of the biggest collections of any single author that has actually endured to this day. The writings of Philo are huge. I mean, you can't even, the book is huge that's translated to English. You know, it's, I mean, this is incredible that this enormous collection from one writer has come down to us. We have the writings of the church fathers, and you can kind of understand why they survived, obviously. And some of them are pretty voluminous. But the Philo text, it's just stunning. It's stunning to see how much of this has survived. And even more stunning is when you go through it, page after page after page sounds like, smells like, and quacks like Christianity. And so, you know, you look through it, you go, well, that really looks like Christianity. And yet, Philo was writing before Christ supposedly started his ministry. And Philo never heard of him, never wrote a word about him, never wrote about Christians, didn't know they existed at all. But we're talking around 25 AD CE Common Era, which of course wasn't dated by that terminology, but when that would have occurred, this is when Philo was writing, and he lived to what? Like,
how did he influence Christianity?
Well, it's obvious that his writings were used in Christianity. And so here's this guy, his father, his uncle was one of the, was supposedly the richest person in the Roman Empire, and was operating out of there in Alexandria, And in fact, his son, Tiberius Alexander, was good buddies with Vespasian. Vespasian destroyed the temple, or Titus destroyed the temple, his son. So this all starts to like become a very personal family affair here. Very wealthy people, one Jewish, one Roman. They're trying, and then there's Josephus thrown in there too. He's friends with these guys too. They're trying to get their hands on the Old Testament, the writings of the Jews. The Jews did not want foreign, you know, non-Jews to look at them. That dirty, filthy infidels again, looking at their sacred text. So that was hard. But so all of a sudden we have, you know, we have very wealthy people coming together, getting their hands on Jewish texts. And Philo had already been obviously working with the Jewish texts, and he had already been working to synthesize Greek philosophy and Greek religion with Judaism, but from a Jewish perspective of superiority. So he's like, you know, trying to improve on the Greek tradition, the Greek philosophy. And he really did some interesting development of, for example, this, the word logos, which means word, reason, it has other meanings as well, but it's basically the word that created the universe. And this has a pre-Christian meaning too. It used to be the goddess used to pronounce this, because they knew that goddess, that women gave birth, and so the goddess would produce the cosmos. But this word logos had been developed very interestingly by Plato several centuries earlier, and then Philo comes and takes this notion and then starts working it into a Jewish Messiah character. So oddly enough, you know, this Jewish Messiah character who's a logos just so happened to have been born, you know, within rowing distance, or I should say kind of walking distance to where Philo was, and yet he never heard of him. I mean, the very thing that he had worked, that he was describing, this logos Messiah, is supposedly born just in his homeland. Now, he's in Alexandria. We don't know if he actually was in Judea, but Alexandria is only 200 miles as the crow flies from Judea, and yet he'd never heard of Jesus Christ. So it's
which
kind
is
of
like a few days' walk.
Yeah. I mean, and remember, these are wealthy people. They would have gotten word. Not only wealthy, but they're connected to the highest echelons of the Roman world. As they would have gotten word that, hey, guess what, Philo? The Logos Messiah that you described to a T in your book is walking around in Judea right now. But
yeah,
no.
You better get over there and see that, because that would be huge news if he had predicted that whole thing, right?
It's so ridiculous. Of course, this is because it didn't happen. Otherwise, this guy would have been the first person to
Wait. You mean it didn't happen? Like, it never happened?
Did not happen. if it had happened that Philus was writing about, I mean, he's describing Jesus Christ to a T, you know, before Christ starts his ministry, and yet nobody noticed.
Like, okay. I've heard this one before. We had to cover this in the last talk. The devil went back there in time and planted that on Philo.
You know, that's the same thing Epiphanius says about Jeremiah describing. He's trying to figure out why the Egyptians are bringing out a baby born of a virgin. And so he's saying, well, because in the 7th century, the Egyptians were listening to Jeremiah talk about predicting Jesus Christ. He's basically admitting that this is a pre-Christian motif. So,
that's,
you know, it's all over the place. You know, come on, these are motifs, they're mythical motifs. Just please, everybody needs to become sophisticated.
It's amazing how we can sit here and judge people's integrity from 2,000 years ago and know how full of crap they were, you know.
Well, it depends on who it was. I mean, I got to say it. This thing with Philo is really key, because think about this. Okay, this person's book survived. I mean, huge writing. Why? Because he was filthy rich. Okay, you didn't have a book back then. Nobody, the average Joe didn't sit down and say, well, I'm going to write a book today and it'll be published tomorrow.
It's kind of like Oprah Winfrey versus you or I, right?
Exactly. I mean, of course.
One of them is going to be an instant bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. The other one, probably not. So unless Oprah calls you and has you come on her show, which is very unlikely.
Well, even if you could get the book in somebody's hands, they have to pay for. Remember, there's no printing press. There's no real. I mean, they had a postal service, but you know, you're talking pretty difficult postal service, to say the least. I mean, everything has to be taken on horseback or by boat.
Well,
or
what about
walking.
What about email?
No email, no computer, no printer, nada. Okay, so if you wanted to write a book 2,000 years ago,
you thought I was serious about that one for a second, didn't you?
Hard pressed. And I do
you
mean
kind of hesitated, like, what is Jan asking me here? All right. You know, so, what? Let's. Okay, yeah. Go ahead. You know, well, I wanted to ask you about the Alexandrian Essenes and sort of go into that direction here.
Well, that all comes together because Philo starts writing about them. You know, and that's really amazing. But remember this: Philo's work, from the evidence that I have seen, as far as I know, Philo's work was actually well known in his day. Okay, so that's like really, you know, I mean, that only happens with the very elite people. So, and
Acharya, it's well known in our day too.
All right, smart alecky. My point is that
he must have been really rich then.
Well, it seems to me that his book must have been widely disseminated. It's one of the few things that survived, and they actually found, I believe they found a copy of some of his work in like Nag Hammadi. Am I getting that right? Or
yeah, I think it was. I think there was some of it found in there. I don't remember which.
Yeah, I mean, you
text,
know,
but I think there's a
this
chunk
is a
of it in
widely,
there.
Widely disseminated work, and highly influential, obviously. So it's not like here's some obscure thing that Christians couldn't have copied. And on top of that, Philo is writing about this interesting group of people called the Therapeutes. And they have a neat little community outside of Alexandria on the lake there. And
why does that remind me of the Qumran story?
Yeah, right. Again, well, there's some correspondences, but there's some differences between them. What we discover then, when we start looking at these secret societies or these brotherhoods or whatever, is that there's this kind of a loose network that they know about each other. They're not necessarily exactly the same. They're not necessarily all under the same umbrella. But what we might not realize from the story, because what I've dug up and put together in Christ in Egypt, I didn't even know, because I'd never seen it before. I dug up some stuff on the Therapeutes and on brotherhoods and so forth from a guy who did work in consensuses. Social movements. And this was like this some obscure work that I dug up that was just incredible, like a gold mine of information about filling out the holes in what was happening in the Mediterranean. You get this picture eventually that this was not just some like, again, unsophisticated, isolated group of people with no communication or whatever. This was all around the Mediterranean, especially emanating from like Alexandria and Rome, was a highly sophisticated network of merchants and sailors and politicians and even lower echelon blue collar workers. There was a union. We didn't know there were a series of unions that they helped let's say there was a burial union. Now the burial union in Rome actually became very powerful. That was Mithraism. But you know the burial union would find out that somebody's husband died, you know, 3,000 miles away, and they'd send the money. I mean, this is how sophisticated it was. It was very similar to what we've got now with networking. And so there was a lot of communication going on between all these different brotherhoods. And oddly enough, these brotherhood network sites, some of them are in the very places where Paul is preaching. That's a whole other aspect of this. But, you know, to get it back to the therapeutes in Alexandria, we find out that this therapeut group, therapeutic, it's a group of healers, that there was a whole bunch of other therapeutes in strategic parts of the Mediterranean.
And they were involved in the heavy use of various types of psychoactive plant drugs.
Antigens.
Yes, FYI.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. You know, what else was interesting is, you know, the Gospel of John has the story of the wedding scene at Cana with all the wine. I mean, Jesus is like...
And, of course, the wine was... almost all wine back then was strong wine as well, which contained henbane and belladonna and mandrake and things
great.
Like that.
And here he is conjuring, like, dozens of gallons of it for the already drunk crowd at the wedding. Yeah, that's very responsible. You make a lousy bartender, huh? But... what we discover is that
either that or a very good one, because I think the point of their wine was to reach
no hangover.
An ecstatic state of consciousness, and not, you know, well, it wasn't about the alcoholic type of high as we think of it. It was more of an entheogen type of high.
I see. Well, then, I mean, if you factor that in, you know what would be an interesting study? Would be like, what kind of wines did they create around Lake Mariotis in Alexandria, which is where the therapeutes were.
I might even have something on that already, but remind me, and I'll dig around and see what there is.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that was a huge wine-producing area. And you have this, you know, massive focus on wine in the Egyptian Gospel of John. And you also have...
The Egyptians were huge into beer production as well. They had many large breweries in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, and the beer was like the communion drink, like the wine and the bread. We had the beer and the bread in the Egyptian text. It's a constant focus of the beer is like really sacred to them. So Lake Mariotis, you have this sect of the therapeutes who seem to have some relationship to therapeutes on the island of Delos in Greece. They have a lot of like Hellenization going on. They're not as isolated or as Jewish, shall we say, I'd say Samaritan or Zadokite, as the Essenes were in Judea. They're more worldly, and I think it was Reverend Robert Taylor called them the Hebrew mongrels or something like this. They were not exactly necessarily all Jews. They were not exactly Samaritans. They could have been Judeans of different or Hebrews and so forth.
Well, if you read Professor Shlomo Sand's recent book, The Invention of the Jewish People, he argues in there, and I think very solidly, that there's no evidence even connecting with DNA and things like that of a Jewish people prior to the 17th century, and that before then it was all strictly a religious connection and not a people.
Okay, well, the point being that this therapeutic group of Jews was not necessarily like just strictly following the Judean text. They had obviously some influence, and apparently they were like lovers of Isis, and we have to find evidence of this kind of interesting. But I mean, the evidence for this stuff is so fascinating. And when you start reading it, these light bulbs pop in your head. It's like, whoa, this is so cool. I really would like more people to read this book so they could we can share in this experience that I've had. Because when I was putting it together, I was like, oh wow, look what I just found. I was running around and telling people about this stuff. But and so one of the things I found with the therapeutes course was that they were not necessarily just strictly interested in the Jewish text. In fact, they seem to be actively working to incorporate, like Philo did, Hellenization, Greek thoughts, and the Egyptian thoughts. And you're in Egypt at this point. And Philo was in Egypt as well. And so what you then find out, so Philo is describing these Egyptians, these therapeutes, and talking about their structure, which their infrastructure, which starts to sound very much like Christian monastery. And remember, he's writing about people who had been in existence before Christ was supposedly born, and they already had like presbyters and other presbyters, other hierarchy in their infrastructure, you know. And so, and it's all about sacred and spiritual, and fast forward to Eusebius, the church historian in the 4th century, and he starts talking about the therapeutes, and he's saying, well, Philo's therapeutes are our Christians, and their texts are their texts are the basis of our gospels. So, you know, what do you do with that? I mean, now you're like, well, there's a smoking gun, isn't it? That they took these texts, and they were called allegorizing texts. That they took Mishnah, you know, this practice of taking texts and commenting on them, and there's a whole like legalistic Jewish practice of constantly reinterpreting ancient texts and creating new ones. Obviously, there's this whole intertestamental literature, body of literature. And so we find out that the writings of the therapeutes are the basis of Christianity. And the therapeutes, you start looking at them, well, they're Isis worshippers, they're in Egypt, they're surrounded by wine production. And I think that that's maybe one of the ways that they made money was through wine. And so then you start looking closely at all of that, and the whole new thing opens up. Well, they're exposed to enormous amounts of Egyptian culture. If Christianity is a rehash of Egypt, that's where we're looking. That's where we need to look. Obviously, these people, Eusebius identifies them as the originators of Christian texts. I mean, let's look there. Instead, that quote from Eusebius has been chalked up as, well, the guy was just senile, obviously. He just lost his mind all of a sudden. He can't possibly be telling the truth. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, of course.
Shut him up!
How else could he come to this stuff? Well, you know, the devil must have went back and planted it in his head.
That devil is always getting the better of God.
He was always getting the better of everybody. You know, let me ask you, what was the Alexandrian influence on the formation of Christianity?
Well, I've just been talking about it, haven't I?
Well, but to summarize more succinctly.
Well, specifically, if we have the originators of Christianity in the therapeutes, in that one part of the world, there's also influence coming from Judea, there's influence coming from Rome, there's influence coming from Syria, Antioch, very important part. And this is why we have so many different voices. But significantly, you know, so many different voices in the New Testament. When you read it, you're like, well, Matthew reads like an Egyptian, an Indian book. We got these Indian myths in here. We got, you know, Luke is very Greek. Mark is kind of Roman. John is definitely Egyptian. You know, of course, there are all these voices coming together. Luke is also very Syrian, Syro-Greco. Antioch kind of thing. So those four things, like the four major influences on Egyptian and on Christianity. And so, you know, certainly Alexandrian influence would be most markedly found in the Gospel of John. And you know, you get to factor in the Gnostics in there. They've got a hugely influential history on Christianity, obviously. And then when you're looking closely at when these texts appear, the canonical Gospels before Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it really is obvious. It starts at the end of the second century is when they appear in the literary record. I don't see any evidence of their existence before that. I go over this in detail of the evidence supposedly from Justin Martyr. I go over the evidence of Marcion, who's actually we call him kind of a Gnostic now, but he was considered to be an Orthodox Christian at the time. Now, he put together the first New Testament in the middle of the second century, around 150. It's Marcion of Pontus. So he's kind of like a Syrian Samaritan type.
The Marcion Bible, correct?
Yeah, and it had just a not all of the Pauline epistles, and it had only one gospel, which was the Gospel of the Lord. And it's my contention that the Gospel of the Lord is the basis, is like an Ur-Lucas, Ur-Marcus necessarily. Well, Ur-Marcus and Ur-Lucas would be pretty much the same, but that Luke takes this Gospel of the Lord, and he rewrites it and adds all kinds of stuff to it, and it's from there that they're also using. Marcion supposedly translated his Bible into Latin and Greek. So there's two versions of the Gospel of the Lord, and one would be Greek and one Latin. And I think that's where we're seeing Mark is the Latin and Luke is the Greek version. And of course, Mark eventually becomes Greek, but that's why it has a sort of a Roman feel that it was the Latin translation that was used in the creation of Mark's Gospel. But you know, this is I do detail this not just in Christ in Egypt. My book, Who Was Jesus, also goes into a lot of details about how this came about, and you can see how it's being formulated. So anyway, so we have this thriving the Therapeutes, but that's in the first century. Come to the second century, we have these Alexandrian Gnostics, and now if there were these allegorizing texts that belong to the Therapeutes, and they've been being worked on during the first century, and then we have these dynamic forces of Vespasian and Titus and Tiberius Alexander, and they are trying to unite Judaism and paganism. There's that evidence there for that too. So that's going on at the end of the first century. Into the second century, you start finding, you know, different strains of Christianity starting to come into being in the second century. You're starting to see it finally. You don't see it in the first century. There is no evidence of it. There's the Pauline epistles that seem to be, you know, the original parts of them are have a first century context, but they seem to have been influenced by Seneca, possibly Apollonius's of Tyana's writings, and you know that could be the Paul who's the basis of these original Pauline epistles. And so Christianity itself, you don't see. You see these writings that are being directed towards mystery schools that already existed, and they're talking about this anointed person, or this anointed being. They're not talking about a person who walks the earth in the first century. We don't have that. It starts about the end of the first century into the second century that you start finding more historicizing. Now all of a sudden this guy, Jesus, really and truly did live. And there's all this objection going on, like with in the writings of, some of the first century, or the end of the first century, beginning of second century writers are repeatedly saying, he really and truly walked the earth, as if they're talking to the Gnostics. And the Gnostics had never said that this Christos, this anointed one, had been walking the earth.
Right, they were very much to the effect that that God would never have manifest because manifesting in physical reality was the antithesis of godliness.
Yeah, the mater, the whole matter thing, and that's where you get into this like misogyny too. You know, mater is mother, and mother is filthy, and blah blah blah. But yeah, the Gnostic take of all this stuff takes place in the pleroma. You know, often like the ethers somewhere, a different dimension. And so we see all of that coming together, these strains of this group over here insisting that these are not necessarily mythical characters, but they're allegories. Their stories take place in a different realm. They're building on Plato and the Platonic perfect man who's you know, in the shape of a cross, and they build a, all this stuff is coming together in the second century. Obviously, there was a huge effort to like unify all of the religions of the Roman Empire. Gnosticism has Egyptian, Syrian, Indian, Greek, Roman, and like even Sumerian influence in it. Some odd, obscure words that are apparently coming from like, you know, way back when. And so the big difference between Gnosticism and Orthodox Christianity, what became Orthodox Christianity only in, at the end of the second century, the big difference between them is, of course, one is taking place in an allegorical, spiritual, mythical world, and the other one is supposedly taking place in the third dimension.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it all boils down to that debate still. Does it take place in the third dimension? There's no evidence of it taking place in the third dimension, and all the evidence points to this being a typical or archetypical myth that predates the Christian era by thousands of years.
And not only, not only that, but it appears that at least large chunks of Gnosticism itself were around long before Christianity. But that's part of what they try and do to maintain the historicity, supposedly, of Christianity, is by saying that Gnosticism was an outcropping of Christianity, not vice versa. But as soon as you flip the two, as soon as you put Gnosticism as the older religion, then it changes everything.
That's right. Because you can find Gnostic ideation in the Egyptian religion. Some of these older texts, even, you know, long pre-Christian, centuries before, and they're continued. The Gnostic movement that we find in Egypt, for example, is not, again, this, you know, alien thing that burst out of nowhere. It's a continuation of an older strain of thought that is Egyptian. And now it's allowing in, I'd like to say, the Syrian influences are what is really making it different from from just being regular Egyptian religion. Some, you know, these bizarre things that are coming out of coming from the East, more bizarre than, say, incorporating Greco-Roman mythology into it. And that's where, you know, Gnosticism becomes this really weird thing that, you know, very few people even comprehended today, much less 2,000 years ago.
Let me ask you this, since we're on the subject of Gnosticism, if I may. Mm-hmm. What were the Gnostic archons?
Oh, God. You have to bring this up.
I had, and
I don't even have, you know, like my.
Just give it a whack, you know. Here. Just give it a whack and see what happens, and you know, if not, we can do another show on it.
Well, here, I'm going to read from my book here, at page 476.
Are the archons UFOs or what are they?
Well, look at this. Okay, my book 476. You know, first I'm talking about this. We're talking about the Gnostic. It's funny how it all dovetails. That's what their intent was, to have it all dovetail.
Well, that's why I asked that question right then.
Yeah, here I'm talking about this Gnosticism and so forth, and being an Egyptian religion. I talk about the Poimandres text and dating to something like 700 BCE that is really representing the Memphite theology, which talks about the logos of God in ancient Egyptian. So that's really interesting. You know, that's the Memphite theology. Now, then I go on and I say, demonstrating both its Platonic and Gnostic relevance, in the Poimandres we find the archons as the seven planets, and then in Plato we find, quote, subaltern demiurgic gods among whom are the heavenly bodies, and they are also called archons or archuntes. And so this Gnostic, the seven planets business, these would be what they called the planets back then, are what we also call the, you know, today, the days of the week, the Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
including the planet Earth, the Sun, and the Moon.
Yeah, well, the 5 days of the week do not include the planet Earth, but.
Okay, well then, some of them do, but okay. So then.
Well, Yeah, I mean, if they knock off one of the other ones, you could include Earth in there. But the five planets that are, you know...
It usually either includes the Sun and or the Earth, and you knock out one of those two, and it's the other six.
Right. Well, the days of the week as we have them now, let's say, but they could have had a different arrangement. But generally, the seven, you know, that would be like the seven candelabra of the menorah, too, with the Sun in the middle and... That whole thing, which is described by Josephus, by the way. You know, I mean, this isn't like we just made this stuff up. We have ancient testimony for all everything. You know what I mean?
Oh, come on, Acharya. Everybody says you made this stuff up.
Yeah, that's why.
Either that, you or Gerald Macy or Madame Blavatsky.
Right.
Come on, face up to
right,
it.
Right, right, right. That's why I no influence of Blavatsky. I mean, like I read like five things of hers.
Let me interrupt you, Acharya. You know, I've read probably not all of your books, but most of your books. And I've got to say that Christ in Egypt, you really kicked some serious ass in that book.
2,400 you know, footnotes.
Right. Well, it was like all of these people, and I won't name them, but it's very tempting. All of these people, it felt to me like all of the attackers that your research and my research have had over the last several years, and all of these people that attack the research without reading the material, or go on Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica and expect to find all the answers there. I got the strange sense that you were mopping the floor with them.
Well, I can guarantee you that if you can actually get through that book, you deserve a gold star because...
Oh, well, I've got an Acharya gold star right here.
It is scholarly. I mean, you cannot get... there is no other level of scholarship. I put my all into it, and I am well-educated, and to say that I'm not is a real insult to the school I went to and my professors and all my teachers. And I know that I have a professor of mine that now who has read this book, and he's very proud to call himself my professor. Believe me. So the languages that I had to dig up all these different languages that I do work in them on a regular basis. But let me tell you, it ain't easy. You got different dialects of ancient languages, like Greek, for example. Homeric Greek is different from the Biblical Greek. That New Testament Greek is a piece of cake. Homeric Greek is not so easy. Then there's in between Homeric and, you know, there's all these different... it was really hard.
Hermetic Greek philosophy was going to be my next question, if you want to tackle that. How did alchemy impact the formation of Christianity?
Gosh, I don't know that one. That's not really a specialty of mine. I mean... alchemy.
What
I
about
avoid that,
Hermetic Trismegistus? Or how do you pronounce that? Hermetic
Trismegistus.
Yes,
that's how I would pronounce it.
Trismegistus.
Yeah, Hermes Trismegistus. Well, I do touch upon that whole subject in Christ in Egypt because some of the Hermetic literature. This is a whole body of literature that is pretty extensive, and it dates back prior to the Christian era. Now, here's a perfect example of what we're talking about with a syncretic religious founder. Hermes Trismegistus means thrice greatest. This is not a one single person or not even a single god. This is a school that many different people wrote under the name of Hermes Trismegistus.
You mean like pseudo Dionysus or
all
Jesus
that stuff.
Or
Jesus? Yes, exactly. Jesus said this and Jesus said that. I mean, when you get into the Nag Hammadi text and those Gnostic texts, and you have Jesus saying this and that. You know, you're not talking about a record that came out of some guy's mouth 200, 300 years before. This is a classic, like Confucius. Confucius say. You know, this is, we grew up hearing that. Confucius said, maybe you just throw in your own sentence. This is what everybody was doing. I'm sure that Socrates, they had Socrates using his name too. Plato was not, you know, going verbatim on everything that Socrates said. He's like, well, this is what Socrates might have said. So Socrates said this and that. I mean, you have dialogues. the dialogues are not, they didn't have stenographers, they didn't have recording machines, they didn't have computers. These, they would think of a hypothetical conversation. You know, Jesus may have been talking to Mary Magdalene, and he may have said this and that. And so now we have the Gospel of Mary. I mean, it's the whole, all that literature that comes out is not evidence that a real historical person lived. It's evidence of people writing under the name of someone. We had, you know, people writing under the name of Solomon. This is all, there's all a precedent for this in, if we want to forget about the whole pagan side of this inspection, we could tear apart the New Testament, which I do, and who was Jesus. Tear apart it on its own merit, dissect it, look at it, analyze it in a CSI style, like I call my book, Who Is Jesus, without bringing in, I didn't even bring in comparative religion into that book. I brought in the Jewish part of it, where you can see that they just copied the Old Testament blueprint. They call it a prophecy. They call it prophetic scriptures. I call it, no, it's a blueprint. They just took the pieces of it and put it together. It's really obvious. Look, the Messiah has to be this and that. They take it from the Old Testament. They put it, they wound it in there. So there's a whole precedent for writing pseudepigrapha, which is, you know, writing in somebody else's name. There's a whole precedent in the Jewish school. So, in Judaism, they were writing the name of Solomon. I mean, there were these, you know, pseudepigraphic texts that are in the names of the great religious saints and patriarchs and so forth. And so, this is not something like if they're already doing that, you might want to have that factor in your mind when you're analyzing the situation. You might want to think, hey, maybe they're doing it again. This practice was done in these other mystery schools too. And when it comes to the mysteries, you really start to lose your divisions. Like, you know, this guy's a Jew, this guy's a Greek, this guy's an Egyptian, this guy's a Roman. They all start to like transcend their nationality and just like you and I are right now. We're talking about something. We're not both Christians. We're not both Jews. We don't have any cultural label on us. We've transcended all that stuff. Well, these guys do this too, like they do in modern masonry. You know.
Oh, well, Freemasonry, how and when did that originally develop?
Well, it all comes together then. When you're talking about the Hermetic texts and these other mysteries and so forth, the Hermetic texts, to finish up there, and actually can bring it over to that side, you know, Hermes was a god of Greece, obviously, but in the Egyptian world, he became equated with Tahuti or Toth. You know, like I said, the pronunciation of Egyptian is questionable, obviously. But this god Tahuti or Toth is like the founder of the mysteries, and so you know you have a whole school that is writing under the tutelage of this patron god that they called Hermes Trismegistus. And
I'm glad I'm not the only one that has a hard time pronouncing that.
Trismegistus, yeah.
You studied Greek.
yes, but that's an odd Greek word, I have to say. I mean, you know, it's not like something you just talk conversational Greek with, but so in the you know, the mysteries, we have these gods that are inspiring. They're the heads of the mysteries. Of Samothrace, there was Orpheus and Dionysus, and there's all a bunch of different other gods that were inspiration for the mysteries. In Egypt, we had this Hermes Toth character, inspiration for the mysteries. And then, you know, Mithra and his mysteries. Now, Mithraism, we have a group of people involved in burials. This was really a burial cult. They had their meetings underground. They really were, the catacombs had much to do with Mithraism. It's a burial guild. Okay, so you could, in essence, say that, you know, Mithra, as he became portrayed in Rome, was the god of burials. Okay. Now, we find out that there is also a god who is a carpenter. And so that's very interesting because, well, Jesus is a carpenter. Well, isn't that interesting that there's this sect called the Mandeans, and apparently their priests are called the Nazarenes, and the Nazarenes are carpenters. And so now we have a burial god, we have a carpenter god.
And the Mandeans also consider Jesus the false prophet in the Rite Ginza.
And they were followers of, supposedly, of John the Baptist. They just happened to be in the area in Babylon where Oannes, the water god, thrived.
Indeed.
We can see what happened there. You know, they took the Babylonian god. So, yeah, I mean, it all starts to make a lot of sense when you put it into the proper context and you actually have the knowledge of the context. If you don't have the knowledge of the context, then, yeah, sure, you can pass this story off as being historical. But you really have to rip away this huge, vast, you know, religious tradition. You have to just throw it away, ignore it, to make this story historical. You have to ignore all the goddess worshiping. You have to ignore the triple goddess, which would be manifested in Mary the Virgin, Mary the Mother, and Mary Magdalene, the, you know, the lover of men. The triple goddess. I mean, you have to throw away all of that to turn these characters into history, historical figures. So, anyway. So now we have a carpenter god. You know, Hephaestus was a smith god. And so anybody who was under the patronage of Hephaestus, the Greek god of the smith, would be, you know, they were smiths. So we have carpenters who have a carpenter god, smiths. And the people who build buildings out of brick and stone are what?
In the middle of heaven.
What kind of occupation do they hold? What are they called?
Oh, I know. Freemasons. Oh, wait, and that means in the middle of heaven. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that what Mason means?
I got totally ahead of myself there for a second. I got a little excited.
I got that effect on men, you know. That's funny.
Now I'm blushing, and I'm not even going to go. I can't even admit or deny anything.
Well, that's refreshing. So, so listen, so Masons, right? So forget about the free part of it, because that's kind of, I don't know, oddly sketchy thing, but, you know, how the word free became attached, there's all kinds of etymological...
Children of light in the midst of heaven, all kinds of kinky things, I don't...
Yeah, that's what it is, that's where you went with that, huh? So, I mean,
well,
you know,
that's
quite
as far
possible.
As I got it. That was as far as I could trace it back. The children of heaven. But I came to the exact same conclusions on it that you did.
Well, I mean, it may have some merit, but it's not germane to this particular discussion. So that's fine. But they would be called Masons. Whether or not there was, you know, a Freemasonic Brotherhood like we see today is irrelevant. The point is that the people who were building all of these massive stone buildings were Masons. And they left Masons marks, which is a kind of a cultic thing to do, in a sense. I mean, that you're communicating something there. You're communicating a mystery. You're communicating something secret. I don't think they were just meaningless doodles and graffiti like we see all over Los Angeles. These Mason marks had some kind of meaning, and they were trying to convey it to future generations or to each other. Now, I have no doubt in my mind that as there was a funeral guild, as there was a carpenter guild and a smith guild, there was a mason guild. And that these masons taught each other things that obviously that they needed to know for their occupation, but then there were organizers of the masons and that they had other things that they taught each other. And so if you have... you know, a smith cult that it has something to do with the smith god, and then you have its own mysteries, then you have smith mysteries. Well, you're going to have mason mysteries too, masonic mysteries. And so this is where it starts. What we are seeing in our religions today are the mysteries of the world, either right in front of our faces without recognizing them, or, you know, having been personified and given roles on planet Earth. They're very well covered up. But, you know, the virgin birth is unquestionably a mystery. Philo talks about it as a mystery, and that it's pre-Christian, unquestionably. And all these great, you know, these mysteries. Now, the ones that are going to be really enduring are the ones that can be encapsulated in stone. And so the Masonic mysteries become quite prominent. the people who are making the most amount of money are involved in, you know, masonry, I mean, building temples and massive buildings. They're making a ton, as they do today. You know, who's one of the richest? Who are the richest people in the world? Donald Trump owns buildings, real estate. I mean, this is they knew it. You know, the permanence is important, especially in when you're talking about like in ancient Egypt, where the big focus of the religion is afterlife, it's permanence, immortality. So building these huge buildings of brick and stone, obviously stone more important, they'll last forever. You know, this is the most influential cult would be the Masonic cult of mysteries, and so this is what we are seeing. These are the people with the most amount of money. These are the people whose mysteries have lasted the longest. Now, do they incorporate the mysteries of other cults? Of course, yes, absolutely. And so this is why we see such a huge conglomeration of these mysteries in what has become Christianity, for example. Yes.
Why is the Last Judgment important to the Christian story?
Well, golly, I don't know. I mean, where's the question coming from?
Book.
You mean you can... You can, you know what, if you're relating it to Egypt, of course, then you would be talking about the Last Judgment scene in the Egyptian text, and that's like really vitally important. So yeah, that's significant. That's a significant point, because I mean, obviously, Christianity has the same focus on the afterlife, immortality, a spiritual heaven, a separation from this world, passage. All that stuff, transition. That's all Egyptian, and the Last Judgment is also Egyptian. You have to go and sit in front of Osiris and be judged. Is he going to let you pass into this world or that world? Is he going to keep you in purgatory and so forth? It's all Egyptian, and so you know. I mean, if you're going to pattern your religion on the Egyptian religion, yes, that would be a huge, huge focus on the Last Judgment.
What you're saying is that we can't say it's all Greek anymore. We have to say it's all Egyptian.
I thought you were going to say, amen. That pretty much says it all, yeah. Amen. Uh-huh. Where'd you get that word from? Amen, Ra, Amen.
That's, yeah, totally hilarious. You know, and we didn't even cover Basilides at all, did we?
Well, when I was talking about Vespasian, there is this interesting character named Basilides. There were a couple of them. One is a Gnostic figure, but the one in the first century, this character, Vespasian. Now, this is a really important part of the Christian formulation. In the first century, you had Vespasian was about to become emperor. He goes to Mount Carmel. He meets with a priest named Basilides there. Now, there's a rumor, and I have to dig up this rumor where I found this rumor, but it makes perfect sense to me. What he discussed with Basilides, the priest, on Mount Carmel, who obviously has a Greek name, and by this time there were actually Greek statues up there. Mount Carmel is this fascinating. I mean, this is like, I think there's some serious keys to this whole puzzle in Mount Carmel, or surrounding Mount Carmel. I'm not going to say that it's actually physically sitting there, but this is a mountain that is strategically located, and it has a history of apparently being occupied for tens of thousands of years. They've actually found Neanderthal bones there, and I think they're in like, you know, a religious context. They're talking about like a spiritual sacred site for, you know, tens of thousands of years possibly, and so. Here you have, by this time, the first century, you have several influences. Like I said, strategically located, you go from there. You know, if you want to pass into Egypt, you have to pass Mount Carmel, basically. And so Vespasian, who's not an emperor yet, is going to Mount Carmel, and he's meeting. Now, by this time, on Mount Carmel, there was not only a Jewish altar, there was also a statue of Zeus. And so there's been already some Hellenization going on here. So really, you know, here we have a sacred site that's already an amalgamation of Judaism and the Greco-Roman religion. And the priest there who has the name Basilides, and as we discover later, he's like half Jewish and half Greek. So here we have, you know, a Hellenized Jew, or a Grecianized, no, rather a Judaized Greek, on this place of, you know, the sacred site, and the Roman comes in. And so this rumor is that they discussed a synthesis of Judaism and Greek religion, or, you know, paganism. And this character, Basilides, then starts, like, appearing in visions to Vespasian. And he's his, like, tutor. And, you realize that, well, it's not so isolated. People think, well, here's Judaism over here, here's paganism over here, and within paganism we have the Romans over here, and we have the Greeks over here, and the Egyptians, and so forth. And they're all, you know, not connected in any way, shape, or form. Well, they all, like, all become connected in this particular era here. Vespasian and Titus are friends with not only this guy Basilides, who apparently is some kind of advisor to Tiberius Alexander, but, you know, they're also friends with Tiberius himself, who is at this point, like, the prefect of Alexandria. He's, like, the ruler, and he's the heir to this massive fortune I was talking about. He's Philo's nephew. Something like that, yeah. And he's the heir to this massive fortune, this Philo family fortune. And so we have Vespasian, Titus, Basilides, Josephus, and Tiberius. And they're all, like, you know, there's this other rumor, too. And these are the ones that are hard to substantiate, that these are all supposedly members of a brotherhood called the Sons of the Sun. Now, of course, it wasn't called that in English, because English didn't exist. It was called that in, you know, Greek, Roman, possibly Hebrew, I don't know, possibly Egyptian, Coptic. But supposedly they are members of this brotherhood that transcends all the other things. They're not, you know, they don't call each other Jews, they don't call each other, which might explain why Tiberius of Alexandria helped to destroy Jerusalem. Here's a Jewish guy. His father helped build the temple in Jerusalem. He helps destroy it. Why? How? You know, how did this happen? These are the hard questions that need to be answered. How did this happen? The wealthiest person, Jewish, in the Mediterranean at the time, wealthiest family is Jewish, and they not only build the temple, but they destroy it. You know, what are the dynamics at play here? What were they thinking? And the most obvious is that they were creating Christianity. They were the motivating factors. They were the money. You know, follow the money. They were the gold. They were the guild. They had the power. They had the ability. It didn't start out with some dreary guy wearing a raggedy white, you know, robe with a bunch of ragtag, dirty, poor followers. It's just so ridiculous. Unless, of course, it is supernatural. I mean, the people who even think that, well, Jesus really existed, but he was this, like, you know, just this nice guy who really didn't have much, and his followers didn't have much, but suddenly they are, like, so influential that they get the whole Roman Senate to, you know, reject its own gods of centuries. And it's like, what? Yeah, that's like telling me there's that guy in Guatemala named Jesus. He's got a bunch of ragtag poor followers, and suddenly he's going to Washington and getting them to throw Christianity out the window and follow him. I mean, give me a break. That's even more supernatural than, you know, this notion that could have happened is even more supernatural than what Christianity is putting forth. I mean, at least you bring God into it. There's a potential that it started off the way Christianity claims.
Discuss Hypatia.
Well, very briefly, I don't know all that much about her, but, you know, in the, was it 4th century, the story is that there was this brilliant woman philosopher who basically, she was mathematically inclined, but she was teaching in the temple of Serapis, the Serapeum, and had a large following, and Christians became dominant, and they couldn't tolerate this anymore, so they attacked her, dragged her out of her chariot, or whatever she was riding on or in, and hideously murdered her. And that was pretty much the end of Egyptian
skinned her alive with seashells, as I've read the story.
Yeah. And that was pretty much the end of the Egyptian religion. I mean, that was the end of paganism. They called it the death of paganism.
That was the beginning of the Dark Ages, as it's been said.
Yeah, I mean, the end of the pagan light. Yeah, that's so that's a sad story. Now, there's supposed to be, there's a great movie out. I haven't seen all of it, but it really is kind of infuriating. You can see why it didn't make it into the movie theaters. There'll be people, like, rioting against Christianity after they watch that one. But, but so that, yeah, that's a terrible story. I mean, that really is, like, seminal. And then after
What's
that...
What's the movie called? I haven't heard it. I haven't seen the movie.
Agora.
Agora.
Marketplace in Greek. Now what happened after that is, they had driven the priests, the Egyptian religion, until they had murdered most of them, and they were only left, like, on the island of Philae, I believe, was the priests of Isis, and there were a few left. And of course, they couldn't even let them live, so they went in there and killed them. I mean, this is like, you can't even let these people, they're over there on an island, you've driven them out of their own land, you've destroyed their religion in their own land, and now you can't even let them exist in this one beautiful temple. Ugh, anyway, don't get me going. So there's that one.
Napoleon Bonaparte, what did he have to do with all of this?
Oh, this is such a fascinating story. There's so many movies to be made about this material. Oh my gosh, where are the people with the vision who want to bag these movies? Come on, we need you.
We're giving them the ideas right here.
Oh my gosh, this one, look, Napoleon Bonaparte. This is the information that I have. It's in books, it's clearly there, but, of course, unless we have the very finger of God writing it down, nobody's going to believe it. But Napoleon Bonaparte had a tutor named Charles Dupuy. Charles Dupuy wrote a book at the end of the 18th century, a series of books, multi-volume book, called Les Origines de tous les cultes, which is the origins of all religious worship. And he in there put forth the theory that Christ, or developed it, I should say, it wasn't the first time it was put forth, that's for sure, the theory that Christ was a solar myth. And now this is in the 19th century in France. He was an abbey, or if I got that right, I may have confounded him with someone else. But he collected a huge amount of data from whatever extant text he could find, in his... I mean, this guy did not have Google Books, folks. He had, it was a collection of whatever was left after centuries of Christian censorship and the Inquisition and the book burnings and the destruction was appalling. But this guy managed to collect together enough, and he didn't even have the benefit of, what happened after Napoleon. His work is still awesome. So Dupuy is the tutor of Napoleon. So Napoleon is under the influence of somebody who is claiming that Jesus Christ is a solar character and not a historical person. Napoleon is also under the influence of another person who became his tutor, who was a student of Dupuy, and that's Count Volney. Count Volney also wrote about the same subject, Christ being a myth. The story is that at one point, and I don't remember exactly who this person was. He was a professor, I believe, a theologian, was in Napoleon's presence, and Napoleon leaned into him and said, "The question of whether or not Jesus Christ ever existed is a good one." Okay, so this is, quite astounding development right there. You have one of the most powerful men in the world making this comment. And having these two tutors who are, their works were widely read among the elite at the time. Of course, the common people never heard about any of this because, number one, they were all illiterate, and deliberately so. And number two, books are very expensive. So even if they weren't illiterate, they weren't getting, the benefit of having these books in front of them. And the library system was not like, we are so lucky in the United States, the library system. Oh, yeah, the Bible, even if they could read, that was not necessarily available to them either. I mean, look what happened to Gutenberg with the printing press. I mean, they didn't want anybody reading the Bible either. So So, but the elite were reading these books, and they were in French. So you actually had to know French if you were in England. The elite did know French, but and the Germans, you know, so forth. But
right.
These two figures were very, very, very. They were so inspirational that, again, the rumor. Now, this is something I want to work on to verify. This is part of what would make this great documentary. Napoleon was inspired to go to Egypt to find the proof that Christ was a mythical character based on Egyptian religion. That is where this all leads to.
That's pretty fascinating.
It's fascinating because he found it.
He did.
He did. He opened up a whole can of worms that has led to this book, Christ in Egypt.
All right. In your opinion, what is the Christian religion? Where did it come from? And what were its primary influences?
Are we summarizing here? Christianity is the exoteric manifestation of ancient mysteries and other exoteric traditions and rituals, and religious concepts, astrotheological ideas, mythology, and some history from thousands of years ago, with influences of Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Sumero-Babylonian, Syrian,
Indian,
and Indian, largely. These are like the major influences, and many minor ones we have up in the great, you know, in Great Britain. We have Jesus, the woodworker, and other gods that were in Thor and Odin and Scandinavian and European gods too. So it's the amalgamation of all of these different religious ideas. A lot of them overlapped. So, and these could, I am convinced that the vast majority of all of these concepts, if not all of them, could be found in the library at Alexandria. And so it's a concerted effort to unify the Roman Empire under one state religion, especially after the end of the second century. You know, but in the beginning of the second century, there's already an effort being made by the elite, a very wealthy elite, and they're using Philo's text and Seneca and everything else that they could find at that point, some Roman decrees, and so on. And so what was the next part of the question? That's what Christianity is.
You pretty much answered it. Where did it come from and what were its primary influences? And then following
that,
I was going to ask you, what was its purpose? So you actually got all of that covered. And in your opinion...
One of the purposes, you know, it's not all bad news. One of the major purposes of this, the story, you know, if you strip away all the myths, people say, well, then there was still some guy who was executed. Well, no, not so fast. That story is not a punitive execution. That story is a expiatory sacrifice. That story is about a sacred king scapegoat sacrifice. And it is an archetypical reproduction of what was being done in many places, even though, you know,
including in the sky.
Well, that too, yeah, the God on the cross in the sky, sure, the vernal equinox and everything else we were talking about, but also the sun, and also we hear so much about the Druids. Oh, the Druids are so cool and everything. Well, they also, under the influence of others, ended up doing human sacrifice, and so even your human sacrifice was being done all over the Mediterranean and beyond into Arabia and, of course, in India as well. It continues in India. It has continued in India, at least into the 19th century, possibly, I don't know, in the backwaters. But also in other continents, it's still going on, human sacrifice. It depends on, you know, your isolated areas. They're still doing human sacrifice. But apparently it was abundant enough to be a real problem. And so, you know, I mean, hey, you got a problem going on in your village? Sacrifice a human. I'm not kidding. This was totally abundant. I go into a lot of detail in my book, Sons of God, about human sacrifice and how this is a classic human sacrifice ritual that we're looking at in the New Testament. They've thrown in everything else, from, you know, but the kitchen sink. But the main story is the sacred king ritual sacrifice. And it follows, like, this has got to be the pattern that they, that, you know, you have this innocent guy, he's representative of God, he needs to be scourged and found guilty of something, and they would, you know, this, in the scapegoat ritual, they would spew all their anger and all their problems onto this guy, and then they would kill him, and apparently, and hopefully all the problems would go away.
That's why it's called the scapegoat, and originally it was a goat, and then it became a man.
Right, or, well, they actually may have substituted the goat for the man, because the human, this human sacrifice thing probably
that's what I meant.
Tens of thousands of years. Yeah,
right.
And you find it in all throughout the Old Testament. First of all, the Old Testament starts off practically at the beginning, you know, Abraham's going to sacrifice his son, and the narrator doesn't even blink an eye, like, well, that's really a weird thing to do. They just say it like matter of fact, that's what we usually do. You know?
Right.
So the reader of this text is not going, what the heck? Today we are. But the reader, when they wrote it, the reader apparently was like, aha, yes, sacrificing your children. Yes, we do that all the time. And so,
right.
You know, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, so that's what we're seeing here. So it wasn't all bad, the reason for this creation of the story. I think it possibly was like to put an end to that. You know, to like say, look, here's the once and for all sacrifice that takes away the sins. That's what this was all about, taking away your sins. And so, but, you know, the only problem with it is to force that on everyone. They had to slaughter and sacrifice millions of humans. Exactly.
All right. Here's a big question, Acharya. In your opinion, has there been an intentional and repeated effort to censor ancient texts and materials?
Well, I actually prove that there has been in Christ in Egypt, because I have dragged up, I like, here, look at this. This book released in English is missing this passage. In fact, that was one that...
Like, just that, like that Epiphanius text that I found, you know?
That's like a really big smoking gun. But there are several other little places that I came across stuff that was... It was like, why isn't this well known? Why is this stuff... For example, let's say, you know, Budge. I actually don't think Budge is as bad as everybody likes to paint him. The Egyptologist, arguably the most famous Egyptologist of all time in English language, anyway. Yay, Wallace Budge. That he... it's very strange how he discusses Plutarch. Now, Plutarch is the writer from the first century into the second century. Who talks about Horus being born at the winter solstice, okay? Plutarch's writings were known in, you know, like 17th, 16th century and onward, and they were discussed. And the people who were, you know, like the mythicists back then would point to, look, Horus is born at the winter solstice. You know, this is what Plutarch says. And oddly enough, when in all of his books, Budge. Now, if there's a reference, I've missed it, but in all of his books, and I've searched them, you know, across Google Books, of course, which gives me a pretty good idea of what's in them when you're doing a search term, I could not find any discussion of that particular passage in Plutarch about Horus being born at the winter solstice. So he talks about Plutarch, Budge does. He talks about the other parts where, I mean, Plutarch's talking about Isis and Osiris. He's given the whole story, Isis, Osiris, and Horus. So he completely, even though I know during that time, Massey had already brought it all up, and other people brought it up. Massey became quite famous for somebody who had, you know, not even two nickels to rub together. Budge knew about him. Budge knew about Robert Taylor. He knew that during the 19th century, people were discussing Horus being born at the winter solstice, and he makes no mention of him. And so it's like that kind of thing, where they didn't necessarily cut it out, but they're omitting it. Just don't go there, don't talk about it, don't bring it up. But we do actually have also evidence of them deliberately editing text. That Epiphanius thing is so egregious. If you read the story of that in Christ of Egypt, you'd be like, holy crud. They're editing out him talking about virgin birth, basically, I think, at the winter solstice, isn't that right? So
right.
That had been completely... They just took it out of the script, out of the original Greek manuscript. The Minya edition is missing that whole chunk. I had to look in the German edition of it.
Yeah, in fact, when I first came across the reference for it, I was having so much trouble with it. I had contacted you to help me pin down what the heck was going on with it.
That's right.
You know?
You passed it along, and it took, I cannot tell you how long, you know how long it took me to get that?
How long?
We had to go and ask a professor at a college somewhere, probably has no idea what he did, to find that. That was a different reference. That was a reference to Jerome, which is also omitted, where Jerome talks about what Luke is discussing in the beginning of Luke says he's drawing on many texts. Jerome is saying that those are basically those texts were from the second century. That's also missing. I had a hard time finding that. It took me weeks to find that. But the Epiphanius thing, I had to. Oh my gosh, that took like 6 months to get that book.
The only copies I found of the original text, one was at the University of Amsterdam, and the other one was like the University of Berlin or something like that. I mean, it was ridiculously hard to find that Leipzig version of the text.
That's right. Well, I ended up getting a copy of the book and Xeroxing that page. But let me tell you, that manuscript has the Greek in it is really hard to read, okay? And I had to search through several pages because even if they identify, you know, in a number on the side, I had to search through to find that those, it was not easy to find what they were talking about. And
right.
then to compare it with the Minya text, you know. So that was really hard. It took me it probably took me 6 months or more to find that book. Maybe 5 months. To get that.
All right.
That's the kind of work that I put into this book. It almost killed me. You know, I got sick. Remember that story. That's the kind of hard work. I worked on this. I labored on this book so hard to get that. It cost me a lot of money to get all those books, too. I had to get those, you know, interlibrary loans. I had to dig
I know the feeling.
Yeah.
You should try studying ethnobotany and see how expensive the books get.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Good boy.
Very quickly, discuss Sir James George Frazer and the Golden Bough. What was his story, and why was he so important to sort of put down?
Put down, you mean to utterly rip apart? Well, you know, he's a British scholar who wrote a multi-volume series called The Golden Bough that really traced the origins of many religious ideas largely to nature worship. He did a really bad thing, though. Now, the thing that, you know, of course, the Christians don't like about him is because he brought up all these dying and rising saviors, and that really knocked the wind out of Christianity. Dying and rising saviors based on nature gods, And
just to be clear, we're not talking about the abridged single volume version. We're talking about the 9-volume unabridged version that hardly anybody knows about.
Right. Well, most people obviously aren't going to read that, but you can get, like, if you go to Google Books again, you can get different volumes on there and search through them. Obviously, to read the whole
exactly.
thing would be quite difficult. He really created quite a storm with all the parallels to Christianity. And yet at the same time, you know, you get this feeling that he was really kind of trying to protect. He was not a mythicist. He wasn't going to say Jesus Christ was a myth. Ultimately his legacy, now of course all of this is being attacked and dismantled because it really created a great, it threw Christianity out the window. I mean, it was like, there's nothing original here. We've got all these different mythical motifs, and they're shared in this culture and that culture. So what the debunkers tried to do was to say that, it all was copied from Christianity. Everything he's saying is there is post-Christian and so forth and so on. Well, that's been refuted, too. And I have the whole discussion of this dying and rising debate in Christ in Egypt as well, using most modern scholars who are often cited supposedly as destroying the case. They actually make the case. But so you have to read that too in there. This is a big book. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of information in there. But Frazer, unfortunately, was reacting to what some people claim was a real over-the-top emphasis on the solar mythology in the 19th century. All these books came out about how, you know, Christianity was based on sun worship and Jesus Christ was a solar myth. And some critics believed that they'd gone overboard and just saying this whole thing could be chalked up to solar mythology, which is not exactly what I'm saying. I mean, it's not all solar mythology. La Luna, the moon had a lot to do with it. There's a lot of lunar mythology. There's a Venus and Osiris,
and
Orion.
So did drugs, as I argue in my stuff.
Yeah,
as well.
That's true. That's true too. You got that covered. Yeah, there's all of this stuff going on. So it's not just the sun, but of course the sun is hugely important because it is a solar religion. Christianity is, and so was Egyptian was largely solar. There's a lot of lunar stuff in there too, but and again Orion and Sirius. But anyway, so in reaction to this solar mythology emphasis, Fraser comes out and he like tries to debunk the whole thing. Like there is no solar mythology whatsoever. It's completely irrelevant. Has nothing to do with any of our religions. I mean, it really was ridiculous how he went bent over backwards trying to say that Osiris had nothing to do with the sun, but just couldn't figure out.
So he basically just recanted everything and tried to kiss ass and appease everybody.
Well, no, I mean, he didn't recant the dying and rising. He just tried to make like Osiris into a vegetation god rather than a sun god. And so Osiris becomes, you know, possibly the green color is chlorophyll. I mean, it is cool. I mean, when you think about it, definitely Osiris has to do with fertility and vegetation. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, without the sun, I'm sorry, there is no vegetation. So he's certainly solar as well. So the whole amputation of solar mythology that ended up, his books, I mean, I haven't read them all, like I say, but if you go and you look at, he actually bends over backwards. He writes chapters on how to just, you know, get rid of the solar mythology. And so, yeah, that was quite damaging to the whole mythicist field. On the one hand, now we have a whole slew of dying and rising gods based on vegetation. On the other hand, the whole solar mythology studies was thrown out. Didn't exist, not important, nothing there. Don't look here. So that was Fraser.
What is the single most important concept regarding this talk that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Well, I would like them really to get into the information that I have worked so hard to dig out because I have found some really, really interesting and fascinating stuff. It all revolves around nature worship, observation of our natural world, the appreciation of it, the relevance of it, and we don't need to worship this stuff. We don't need to revere it as a religion, but just to appreciate it and be in awe of it, I think, is a healthy perspective. And I think not only is it healthy for the individual, because it gives you a reason for living. It gives you a reason to get out of bed every morning. I mean, when the sun shines through your window, does it not make you feel happy most of the time? Unless you have a solar energy allergy or something. But for most people, it makes you happy. It gives you a reason to live. But also, because we have to start esteeming our natural world more, or we will be in serious trouble down the road. We've caused so much destruction to the natural world. And then not only does it help you value the natural world, but also it helps connect all human beings on the planet to each other. So it helps remove this religious pathology that is dividing us. We all live on the same planet. We all drink water. We all need sunlight. The earth needs the sun to grow, for the grass to grow and all the plants to grow, and so on and so forth. But we all live under the same moon. You know, it's a common focal point for the entire human family.
Give out your websites and book titles, and of course, your contact information is on your websites.
It is. TruthBeKnown.com is my main website. I also have my publishing website, it's StellarHousePublishing.com. My blog is freethoughtnation.com. I'm on Facebook. I have a very busy Facebook page with maxed out friends, but I also have a fan page for the overflow. And let's see, the books are Christ Conspiracy, Sons of God, Who Was Jesus, Christ in Egypt, The Gospel According to Acharya S. I've got an astrotheology calendar. Hopefully we'll get a new one out. And another book I've published is called Man Made God by Barbara Walker, and that's also fascinating because it gives a lost history of the goddess-worshipping cultures.
And we'll be interviewing her soon.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. We got to do one together with her. But
definitely. All right,
it's been
Acharya.
A pleasure.
Likewise, and thank you so much once again, and we'll get in touch with you here in the next couple few weeks to get you and Barbara scheduled and have you back on again for another round.
Super duper. Thank you so much, Jan. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Can we make